Today's podcast is sponsored by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/westworld and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title for free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/westworld or text westworld to 500-500 to get started. Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast for Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 9, titled Vanishing Point. What did you think of this episode on second viewing? Third viewing, maybe.
This is the first episode of Westworld, I think this season, where my opinion of it changed pretty dramatically. Like, I liked it, but I could tell I wasn't as taken with it as you on the Instant Take, or Instant Talk podcast, rather. And, And I think it's because I was mostly centered on what I was thinking about myself. Like, what are my expectations and what am I getting out of this plot? And when after I kind of like got over what we are not getting or clarity or not clarity and just looking at the characters and their reactions, I was pretty taken with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some really good stuff here between Emily and William. And, you know, there's a lot of... A lot of father-daughter moments here on the Father Day episode of Westworld.
Yeah, some of them fake, some of them not.
Where a father possibly murders her daughter. You've got, you know, Ford and Maeve. And there's a lot of, like, really interesting parallels. Like, you know, no, we don't know for a fact if William's a human or not. We don't. They kind of play coy about Emily and a lot of other stuff. But, like, we did find out a lot of interesting things about our characters and how they relate to each other and how... Like, interesting new parallels and developments. Like, you know, Dolores, arguably, her heart has gone dark this season and has led to her lover committing suicide in much the same way that William's heart led him to kind of be despondent and angry and bitter and led to the death of his spouse. So, from that angle, there was a lot of really interesting thematic and character developments. The stuff that we've kind of honestly been crying out for.
Yeah.
So I really liked it, and I really appreciate it. And it's also just, it's just damn hard to be this ambiguous this late into the season about so many things. And as I watched it a second and a third time, I really would marvel at kind of how expertly they dance on that knife's edge. Without it being too frustrating. I know some people are frustrated, but I found it pretty great. What about you?
On second and third watches...
You hate it.
No, I like it even more, honestly. I think once you can... So I spent a lot of my time this week not reading as many theories, but trying to understand thematically what this episode is going for with William and Emily, most importantly. And I think once you can get beyond the questions of... Is one of them a host? Is one of them not a host? It becomes much more interesting because then laid bare are the characters' motivations. And that's what we're really getting at here. Like, who is William? Who is Emily? What kind of relationship have they had? And I think, I almost think that, like, the knife's edge that you're talking about gets in the way of those things because the questions I was asking coming out of the episode is, which one of them is a host, if either?
Yeah.
You know? But I think it's about more than that. It's more about the man in black, William, admitting to himself who he is and then wondering, whether that's the real him that he's seeing. Because, I mean, he likes to think of himself as the nice, kind William that we know in the real world.
That's the face he presents.
Right. And he shed that skin and he realized, you know, when he was an old man that the true him was the him that is in Westworld. And the him that is in Westworld is now, I feel, coming into question because now he's questioning if he even has choices at all. It's this whole idea of Tim Shell, which I went down a rabbit hole trying to research because I think it's important to this episode. But I think that's the fundamental question here and the reason they don't answer it, right? Because it's not about the answer to that question. It's about William questioning it. And that's the thing that came into focus for me on second, third watch, which makes it, in my opinion, a more interesting episode.
I don't think it's not about that stuff, because clearly those questions are
but
going to be.
But next week will be about that. Important. This week.
And it's maybe that's other, like, if we're going to do a meta criticism of the show, is it feels like there's two distinct audiences of this show. One that's just watching it and, you know, they're essentially letting the horror, the haunted house scare them.
Yeah.
And then the others, represented by us and the theory people, they're going through the haunted house with flashlights and infrared goggles. And I feel like that it's very hard to serve both those audiences. And sometimes it feels like only one audience is being served by a particular episode because you just can't. And this, it feels, was this is serving the audience more that's just along for the ride and don't care over much about where the plot is going and wouldn't be frustrated by equivocations. And like, it's, that's what I'm saying. Like, I wonder.
I think it's serving an audience that has a little more trust that what they're telling us is real.
Well, I don't have any of that trust. Because,
that's what I mean. It's only
or don't
after,
mind being fooled either.
Or don't mind being fooled. Yeah. And it's not trying to figure it out, get ahead of the writers. You know,
right, right.
It's only after I cemented in my mind what I think about the status of Emily as host or not host that my feeling on this episode became more clear.
Right.
Because I do think, like, if you're just watching it, the episode is trying to tell you something about that. And the people who really, really want to dig into the details and question, is she, isn't she, are missing the point.
Right. And, you know, just from a purely aesthetic viewpoint, I think we had some, like, powerhouse acting scenes. Like, I talked...
Oh, yeah.
I talk about it being, like, monologue heavy. But, you know, monologues give actors opportunity to flex and... Anthony Hopkins was flexing all over the place, and even Evan Rachel Wood, who I think has been largely contained this episode, this season. Like, her reaction to Teddy's death on subsequent watches was incredible.
Yeah,
and maybe even worked better because she was a more of a one-dimensional villain character. Largely this season, or, like, I don't want to say one-dimensional villain or whatever, but she's largely driven by vengeance, which is something that's hard for a lot of people to relate or root for, you know, even when it's well deserved, especially when there's multiple sides. Like, if this was a show that had no Maeve and had no Bernard, then it'd be much easier to just be like, yeah, Dolores Slay, you know. But since there are other sides, even on that faction of self-aware hosts, she ends up being the low woman on the totem pole because her, you know, desire to slaughter all of humanity is fundamentally less sympathetic than, you know, striving to be free and wanting to be regarded as equals or in suffering, you know.
Yeah. And I think it's also not as nuanced as some of these other characters.
Right.
Like William, for instance, is, in my opinion, one of the most nuanced characters in, other than maybe Ford. You know, Ford has a lot of interesting perspectives and ways of communicating those. But I think, like, everybody across the board just nails it. You know, you talked about Evan Rachel Wood and Ford. Anthony Hopkins, but I mean, Ed Harris and his voiceover and his confession, like, all of that stuff is just powerful. And then even like Maeve's silent, voiceless reaction to what Ford is telling her about, you know, you stayed in this world to save your child. I'm doing the same.
Right.
Like, all of that is landing and you can see it in her eyes.
Yeah.
And Teddy. I mean, Teddy is, you know, we don't give James Marsden a lot of credit because Teddy has been one note in a lot of different ways over the course of these two seasons.
Yes.
But I think in this speech, this is the most nuanced and interesting his character has ever been.
Sure.
Right? That idea of battling his programming with his cornerstone memories of who he is, that's interesting.
And I think it'll be significant to Dolores to realize that the thing that ultimately kept Teddy from falling to darkness, he died the hero before he lived long enough to become the villain, was her. Like, you know, she's going to have a lot of it's going to be interesting to see, like, if they play with the idea of her, like, having a similar epiphany to William, except for instead of realizing that everything's bullshit and, you know, use that to satisfy and gratify her selfish desires and give in to the darkness, if she has the epiphany that, no, this was something real and irreplaceable. And maybe William doesn't want to admit to that he got his heart broken by a machine, but... That, you know, it was something that is wasn't irreplaceable because like they're playing with that the thing that Anthony Hopkins says about the trying to fix the hole in their code, you know, like, you know, a lot of times when you when a relationship ends badly, you talk about that ripping the heart out of your chest, like he's kind of walked around like that, and I don't think he's really dealt with that grief and that cognitive dissonance from that situation in any kind of healthy way.
No, they're definitely like paralleling William and Dolores in this episode, right down to like killing the people they love.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also, everyone could be a host at any time.
Sure. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I have my opinions on whether or not Emily is a host, and I'm going to state them when we get to those scenes.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I'm right.
Yeah, there.
I think that's what the episode is trying to tell us.
Exactly. There are carefully constructed arguments, and I saw that play out a lot. That there are strong arguments for about anything that you want to make, or there's evidence. I won't say that there's strong arguments. There is evidence leading down almost any path you want to follow. Mm-hmm. You want to let the breadcrumbs leave you. So, and that's again pretty remarkable in the penultimate episode.
Yeah. Should we get into the recap?
Yes. A couple things before we get to the main episode discussion. We are going to live watch the original Westworld tomorrow. What that means is 9 p.m. on Wednesday, June 20th. There'll be an article published on baldmove.com. Actually, be published like 8:50 Eastern Standard Time. You can start queuing up, and we are going to watch a copy of Westworld and let you watch it with us. Essentially, cameras on our faces will be it's like Riff Tracks essentially, or Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Mostly jokes.
We're going to be mostly jokes.
Some jokes, talking about the movie.
Probably talking about Westworld stuff too. So maybe it'll be interesting. Yep. Maybe it'll be funny. Maybe hopefully it'll be both. But we're going to be doing it. And if it's just for club members, you have to be a club member to experience that. You can go to club.baldmove.com if you'd like to sign up in advance of that. We also have our Expanse podcast coming out later this week. Don't forget about that. That's another awesome science fiction show y'all should be watching. I want to talk about the schedule for next week because it's going to be a little different because I'm going to be traveling. So we're going to have the Instant Talk podcast as normal. First half for everybody, second half for club members only. And then we'll have the full podcast out Tuesday, but it will be sans feedback. We're going to take all, since it's a wrap-up podcast the week after, and since, you know, all the theorizing for the individual episodes will be over and it's going to be all talk about season 3, we're going to push all that to have a supersized wrap-up podcast the week after. So you can send in your feedback. Please do send in your feedback, but it will be considered the week after. And then finally, I have something kind of personally exciting to talk about. I've been working on this project with a religious scholar by the name of Anthony Ladon to create a book on Game of Thrones. It's essentially like a mock scholarly analysis of the religions and mythos behind the Game of Thrones and their real life counterparts from our own, from Earth's own history and culture. We are kickstarting it because we're wanting to make it like a very professional project and have like typesetters and proofreaders and editors and cover artists and all that, and a physical copy of the book if you're into that kind of thing. Go to book.baldmove.com. That'll automatically redirect you to Kickstarter. We can get a bunch of more information about that. But yeah, please, if you're a fan of the work I've done here and on especially Game of Thrones, the lore podcast, the spoiler things, please check it out. I think you guys will dig it. Book.baldmove.com.
Okay, we start off with the voiceover of William talking about the darkness inside him as we go to a party. He calls it a stain. As we flash back to a party where William and Juliet, his wife, are pretending that they're a happy couple. I look at this and I start questioning, like, how are they going to bring this around to her suicide in a single episode, you know?
Yeah, but you know what? I did on subsequent watches, I noticed that you see the brittleness of the relationship even in here.
Yeah.
Like, there's, and that's why Cela Ward is so brilliant. In one episode, she's able to really take the stubs of the character that we've kind of put together over the years and then embody this, like, you know, wealthy.
Oh, shit. Cela Ward is embodied stubs. Is that where you're going with this?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I'd like to hear this theory.
I got evidence for it.
that she's this kind of, like, you know, disillusioned socialite that has everything that she could possibly want except for the love of her husband, who she is...
Mm-hmm. The authentic love, right?
Who she suspected is kind of a monster.
Yeah. Because he seems loving by all outward appearances.
Right.
but there's something underneath.
Right. It'd be, you know, and the other thing is, like, they also, there's the other thing I realized that another meta level is, like, if you want to make an argument that she's kind of crazy or has an addiction problem that is obscuring her, because, like, I am open to the idea that maybe William's all right. Maybe he just deals from a lot of guilt. And it's like, if you, you know, this is the mental experiment we had in the last podcast. Like, if you live a perfectly great, good life and you're dutiful and you're faithful and you're kind and loving and generous to your children and to the community, and you have this one video game where you like to just be a real fucker in, yeah, does that make you a bad person? Is that unmask the darkness? But I mean,
or that underneath you just feel, you know, in your bones that it's all an act.
Right.
It doesn't negate the fact that you are making the choice to be a good person.
Yeah.
Right? Like, now, it's interesting here because he's making both choices. He's making the choice to be both evil and good.
Yeah.
So it becomes a little muddier. But, yeah, I mean, the whole thing at the end is, what is a person if not their choices?
Sure.
In the real world, William is making the right choices. Choices.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Westworld, he's not.
But it's also how we feel about those choices. Like, so you're a kid and you're raised in a fundamentalist Christian church, and you are told that masturbation is a sin and it makes you unclean and it gets in the way of God loving you. Mm-hmm. And then your hormones hit and you start masturbating. Like, you're just the same as a kid, any other kid that's like, you know, like, hey, I'm tugging on my penis and or rubbing my clit and it feels great. Uh-huh. Now you've got this layer of this is dirty and shameful and like, that's significantly less healthy, but it says nothing about the act itself.
Mm, that's true, yeah.
So, like, that's what I'm, like, getting at. Are they playing with the idea that, I don't know, because it seems like Westworld wants to put, like, this theory that largely says the things that you do as a hobby or a game that you think is free from other people's prying eyes can be dirty and shameful and wrong, even if they're not hurting other people. Mm-hmm. Or you find out later that it's hurting other people. Like, how do you feel about it? But I don't know, because they've stacked the deck. In this particular video game, the people are real.
Sure,
and
yeah.
They have opinions and consciousnesses and feelings that can be hurt. And so, like, they've really stacked the deck on that fundamentally interesting question. But I think they are playing a little bit with this idea because, like, you never see, like Logan and Juliet are seen as kind of like these deeply addicted. They're about to be in, you know, about to be committed against their will to, in Julia's case, a rehab facility. Like, I think they're playing with even that uncertainty. Like, well, maybe William's not a bad guy. He just has all this guilt and fraud complex is fucking with him. I don't believe that.
Yeah, and paranoia, and I mean, he's clearly got mental issues.
Right.
And yeah, also, I don't know where choices, to draw the line on evil.
And also, like, if our choices define us, mm-hmm. And you can make evil choices in a consequence environment, then you have to, like, if both of those things are true, then you can turn evil from these kind of, like, fake choices that you make. Hmm. Like, if it's so real you can't tell the difference, like, maybe that's just something they're playing with. Because I think that's something we all do well to think about. Like, you know, 50 years from now, where you do have ultra-realistic killing and fucking simulators, is that going to be as harmless as we want to say, like, Mortal Kombat was in our day? Like, nobody's ripping people's spines out because they saw it in Mortal Kombat. But, like, if you can actually rip a person's spine out and it feels real and taste the blood, maybe that could drive you crazy.
I think you're right that the show has an opinion on this. And when they talk about, you know, if you can't tell, does it matter?
Well, the other thing
is, if you ask that question, like, am I doing evil things?
Right.
Are these hosts real? And does this have an evil consequence to me? If you can't tell, does it matter?
Well,
you're evil, you know? If you can't tell whether this thing is alive or not, and you do something evil to it, that makes you bad.
Speaking of not telling if someone's good or evil, why are we convinced that Ford is sliding a real, authentic personality profile across to William?
Because we've seen all the things on it.
Yeah, but, like, the conclusions that he's a paranoid, delusional psychopath, like, you know, is everyone that goes to Westworld fit to, like, I'm just asking a question. Like, maybe Ford is gussing this stuff up. That's what I'm saying. Like, yes, he did all those things, I've done terrible things in video games too. Like I don't know how I'd feel about like having someone slide a SD chip across to me that says congratulations.
Got a surprise for you.
We saw what you did in Skyrim with the cat girl, you fucker. it's they're straight to hell for you. Like I don't know. Like I feel like that's another possible narrative trick they could be playing. That Ford, not because he's evil, but because he's trying to free his creation, is intentionally assassinating William's character, using his wife's paranoia and feeling that something's wrong against him to like kind of like put this, because it does feel like this was the nail in the coffin for his wife.
Yeah.
Like getting the confirmation that, yes, your husband is a certified to a scientific degree of accuracy psychopath is what caused her to kill herself.
Yeah, no, and the description, funnily enough, on or you know, aptly, is on HBO Go of this episode is "Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything."
Right.
And if you're not familiar with Nine Inch Nails' "Hurt" song, that's the opening, or that's one of the lines in the song, which is about like hurting yourself to feel the pain of it, to really just for the pain of it. Mm. And I feel like that is what Man in Black William is doing here.
Right.
You know, his whole motivation is driven by the pain he feels, the guilt
right.
that he feels over essentially causing his wife's death.
Yeah, and the reason I want to drag into this like questioning the morality of it is because I think the show itself does this. At the end of this scene, as they're doing all this montage stuff and he's rubbing his forearm and he's saying like a voiceover is, when did it begin, this tiny fleck of darkness? Was it all in my mind? Was it a remnant of the dream? And then Juliet comes in, is this real? Are you real? Like,
yeah,
they're wanting us to think about this stuff.
Absolutely.
Whether it's misdirection or actually like, you know, William was a host for all along. He's a project, a runaway, out of control cyborg project of Ford, or Ford's fucking with his like there's a lot of room for those speculations, but they certainly want us to be thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to view it in the context of his choices at the end as well. Like, you look at his guilt driving him to this paranoid, delusional action of killing his daughter because he thinks it's Ford, right? And then he comes around and sees, oh, no, that was actually my daughter. I've just done a truly horrible thing. And then he, in an effort to, well, I don't even know that this is a conscious thing by him, but at that point, he turns not from feeling the guilt and that driving him to burn this place down or solve the mystery or whatever, but to questioning whether he's even responsible for it, whether he even has a choice at all.
Yeah.
Like trying to absolve himself of the guilt that he now feels doubly for killing both his wife and his daughter.
Right, right.
And I think that's a really big turn for William at the end of this.
Sure.
Anyway, we go on to the next scene where William wakes up to Emily patching his wounds at a rally point, and she tries to get him to open up about Juliet's death by telling him a story about a music box that Juliet gave her that she threw in the trash. Didn't like it. Because it reminded her that her mother didn't actually care about her, or probably cared about her, but was too drunk most of the time
too drunk dealing with her father, who's a psychopath.
Yeah. I found it interesting. The first thing he does when he wakes up is look immediately for his gun.
Mm, right.
Just shows you know, where his priorities are.
Right.
Anything else about this? I mean, we'll talk about the music box later, I think.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like I said, here's the other great ambiguity is that, you know, Emily has a giant red med pack that could, for all we know, have near miraculous healing powers. So, like, I was ready to just, on the end of last episode, just be like, well, there's just no way he's not a host. Like, he survived multiple gunshot wounds, one right, like, dead center of his mass. Like, just from a bleeding out perspective, that's a problem. I don't know how much of it a problem is now. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because like we've seen him like miraculously heal from wounds before, like at the party in the morning. Is that evidence that he's a host, or is that just this show is 30, 40 years in the future using near miraculous technology?
In a world where we've essentially conquered every disease.
Except for perhaps death. So it's another masterful riding of the edge of ambiguity, I think.
All right, move on to Dolores meeting with the Ghost Nation, who tell her that her journey is at an end, and they're here to put it to her. And when they try to stop her, there's a battle during which all of the Ghost Nation are killed, and we see Dolores deliver the line in the recording that Strand found earlier in the season. And Dolores tells Teddy to search and kill anyone else he finds, but when he finds a Ghost Nation dude, he can't shoot him.
Yeah.
This is all the cracks are showing in Teddy.
Who's right? Is the Valley the Valley Beyond is a door to the new world. It's also a tool that can destroy humanity.
They're
it's an Obi-Wan Kenobi point of view thing, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah.
What is I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay. I guess let's move on. Hale's treated to a demonstration of the admin code taken from Maeve and uploaded to Klim. And Klim takes control of about 20 hosts and has them all viciously attack and murder each other. Quite pleased, Hale tells the tech to get word to Stubbs and prepare to release the virus that is Klim into the wild.
Hmm.
They modified Klim into a weapon. This is exactly what Dolores was afraid of.
Yeah, and what's interesting is we know from the Akane no Ma episode, Akane no Mei episode, that Klim is, you're supposed to understand, is a daughter figure to Maeve.
Hmm.
But they haven't really, they've actually given Maeve an actual daughter. I wonder if there's something to the fact that they've corrupted this child of, it's not Maeve herself. This, you know, like that's what we thought we were going to, that she's going to be used against her will. It's this surrogate child of hers. But I don't know, because again, they haven't really played with the fact that that Klim is her daughter much, because she's had an actual daughter.
Yeah, I wonder if that's more of just like Lee shortcutting the narrative process. He's like,
or it could be,
well, there's this daughter idea. Let's just transfer it on to the madam here, or not the madam. The
right. It's a chicken or egg problem.
I guess.
Is it her reveries and remembering of her daughter that allows her not to fully embrace her surrogate daughter, Klim?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just think it's interesting. I also don't. I'm not crazy about the idea of the host just turning into berserkers and killing each other.
No.
Nah, I don't know. Like, I think it would be kind of more horrific if she just raises her hand and they all just, like, die. Like, they're just gone.
Yeah.
Because it's just weird that they're being raised from the dead just to kill each other again. I don't know. This goes back to, like, I just, every intersection of host and human on this show, I have a quibble for almost every aspect of it.
If I can play devil's advocate for a moment.
Do it.
Maybe
Satan.
They want to physically destroy these hosts so that they can't be retaken. Because, you know, if they do something in software, that can always be undone, right?
Right.
If they physically dismember and destroy
these
hosts.
But what does that
even
fucking mean? When a host gets stabbed in the chest, they were already physically disabled.
Yeah, like, but like snapping a neck. I mean,
snapping a neck, but there was a lot.
Destroy the physical structure of the body to the point where it can't function.
Right. It would paralyze them. But like, I didn't see a lot of neck snapping. I saw a lot of gouging and poking and beating.
Yeah.
And like, I just they're here in a heap because they were already killed. Mm-hmm. So, and again, there's a way to tell that story, and that's not. It's just like this sheer, almost zombie-like savagery. And I think one of lasting criticisms of season two is when they have these chance to deal like with this, like just thematic, like oh, we want something savage, so let's just do like, they definitely let the themes and metaphors direct the plot, and I don't know if that's the way to go about it in future. Maybe if you want to do that, then you got to spend twice as much time on the plot to try to make it seem natural,
right? Yeah.
Because else it's a little bit like, okay, I get it, but it's not even the most, you know, it doesn't feel like it's the most interesting thing that could even have happened with this given set of possibilities.
I do feel like the makeup job they're doing on Klim is doing wonders.
Oh,
for that. Combined with her,
the visual,
I guess, lack of acting,
the visual aspect of her is very creepy and horrifying.
Yes,
like she could just show up in a James Wan picture and be like Conjuring 3.
Yeah,
it's just Klim. The demon is undead Klim.
Yeah,
I'd be
terrified.
You're gonna slowly pan over a dark house. It's kind of in disrepair, and she's gonna be standing there in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fucking undead Klim. Yeah,
yeah,
she's great. The design of her character is amazing.
All right, having seen this demo, Ford tells Bernard that he has one last thing to do before they go. And that's it's just kind of a quick scene here. Yeah, they don't tell us what
Maeve.
It is.
It's
we'll
Maeve.
Find out.
He's got to go say goodbye to Maeve.
Yep. So Emily reveals that she knows all about the secret project that William has been undertaking, thanks to Wasted Uncle Logan, and acts like she understands the point of it all. They both acknowledge that they have an angle on the plan, though William doesn't state what his is. And when asked what hers is, Emily says she wants in on the project.
I mean, here's a lot of the dose of ambiguity because, like, you know, Ed Harris is playing the, you know, Emily is a host game on Reddit. Like, this is a big place. You could wander around here in months and not find a single person. How the fuck did you get here? And she just says, I looked everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe it's fate. Maybe it's an accident. Like,
there are a lot of weird things stacking up with Emily.
Yes. Yes.
The least of which is her starting this journey in Raj World, which or the Raj,
right?
Which I find odd.
Yes,
because I don't think that's where she would look for her father. Why is she visiting the pleasure houses before
and
she goes?
Why
on this
is
mission?
A character that we absolutely know as a human saying, "Why would anyone go to the trouble of making a host appear to be a guest in this?" Like, I mean, they've been asking this from the almost practically day one. I know that wasn't literally the day one episode, but like,
yeah.
Holy shit, like, stuff like this, in fact, the only reason I kind of doubt that Emily is a host is because it would cheapen Ed Harris with the gun to his head moment towards the end of this episode, where he's really contemplating what he did, if he could just be like, well, surprise, old man, you were right all along, she was just a host, like,
yeah.
I don't know, but yeah, there's definitely arguments you could be making on both sides. And Emily just pivots into it like, well, you're a control freak and you want to have everything to do with control, which, you know, William denies.
So there's another thing that's interesting that the Man in Black says in this scene. He says that this project has nothing to do with control.
Right.
Which one of the theories that has been floated is that they're going to try and replace humans with hosts in the real world and use that to profit. Essentially, to have control,
which is certainly a form of control.
World.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. So, in light of that being ruled out, I really have no guess as to what the final plan.
Well,
is
also,
here.
I think you're supposed to understand that William's an unreliable narrator. Like, he could be lying, he could be wrong. His view of what Delos is trying to do could be different from Delos himself, or what Delos the corporation is, because it doesn't sound like maybe he's on the best terms with all of the board, or maybe he doesn't see eye to eye. I it's tough. That's definitely what he said, though.
It is, and I guess I don't view William as a character who intentionally lies or misleads.
But he's
very
a paranoid
often.
Delusional.
He is, certainly.
So, like,
yeah. But he's also the person at the heart of this project. If anybody would know, it's him. He came up with the idea initially.
If he's a real person and not a host and not, like, yeah, I mean, there's, but I'm just saying there is certainly
room. Even if he is a host, he's still a recognizable version of
But why
William.
Would they tell the real host the real, like wouldn't William do his job better if he was
already
slightly deluded? He's a Buzz Lightyear kind of thing.
I mean, I guess I don't know how the project would, well, the project is implied to have spun a little bit out of his control anyway.
Yeah.
Because
I mean,
he
could
Ford
go, like, I saw a crazy, someone, I don't even know if it's crazy, it might be true, that, like, Jim Delos and Logan are actually chilling in the Forge / Cradle. Mm-hmm. And manipulating William to do all their dirty work to take the fall. I got the, like, two sentences in that theory, and I'm like, the fuck? But
okay,
it's, there's evidence you can kind of look to support that. So, I mean, I think, yes, William does not think that the project is about control.
Yeah.
Even though that doesn't seem to jive with what he told, like, you know, and the other thing is we were told this episode that everything about him, including his entire being, is a lie. So, like, I just want to throw some caution into, we can't take his words as gospel.
That's fair. All right, we flash back to the party again. Emily's on her way out, and she notices her mother is drunk, and she wants to take her home, but William says he'll take care of it. And he heads off to the bar, where he encounters Ford, who is insistent that the Delos Project has interfered with his stories. And Ford passes William a card with what I'm going to call self-knowledge on it. Juliet breaks some glassware, and William decides it's time for them to head home. Ford says, one final game, as he leaves.
I think it's significant that when we flash to the night of the benefit party, William's first words to his daughter is, save me. like, that's a direct connection to the previous scene.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, well, you're not the one that needs saving, talking about his mom, their mom. Well, now that the mom's dead, I don't know what to do with that, but I think that's another piece of information you're supposed to stack on the, you know, who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth.
It is a nice moment. I like that.
But on the other hand, it's also part of a context of a larger lie that he's allowing to happen. Like, he's allowing people to believe that his wife is crazy and a drunk just cause, when in fact he is a psychopath. So who knows?
Yeah. Are we sure after this scene? I'm not 100% sure that Ford doesn't want to just stick it to William.
That's what,
like,
I'm saying.
Like, one final game could be one final fuck you,
right,
to this man who has interfered with his life's work the whole time.
And I think you're supposed to believe that Ford got the idea to fuck with him after this conversation. But, like, if you believe the file theory, that could be the opening gambit of a chess match. You know, mm-hmm. like sliding that across the table was him sliding his pawn up two spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
But I mean, do you have an interpretation of what one final game, what the final game is?
I mean,
is?
It's clearly this door.
Yeah, but are we any closer to knowing exactly what that door is? As it respects William.
No, not unless you want to fast forward an hour to the spoiler, to the theory section. But more to the point about, like, the William being a liar, and like my caution to, like, really think twice about using anything he says as gospel, is he also said that he doesn't, we also knew that he doesn't drink
mm-hmm.
outside the park. Unless he just goes fuck it one night and has Macallan. So, like, yeah, they really are telling a story that you cannot on multiple storytelling levels, that nothing that William can that William says or believes is necessarily to be trusted.
I guess I would not equate one drink over the span of X years as drinking outside of the park.
No, I'm saying in context of this scene. Just like him saying, save me, a year before his daughter comes in the park to save him, isn't especially relevant in real life. But since they're making this thematic connection in the same episode where his wife says, you are not just a liar, you are a lie.
Yeah, I mean, we know that he's delusional.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he believes that the only two people who could know about that profile mm-hmm. are himself and Ford.
Right.
And he's wrong.
Right.
He's just straight up wrong about that.
And he's also, like, it's not even about being lying, you're right. Or sometimes he just doesn't have all the evidence, even
yeah.
though, since the universe spins around them, he might think he does.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if Ford will ever have one of those moments. Like, because they also portray Ford as a similar master of the universe, but he's just never wrong.
I mean, he's God. He's God in this world.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're ever going to go with Ford being completely wrong about
it. Or maybe
the
story is Ford being wrong was 30 years ago. Yeah. Like, I fucked up at a very fundamental level, and I am now atoning for all of those mistakes I made.
So, I mean, he fucked up very recently with Maeve, right? He tried to guide, make a path for Maeve.
That's true.
He should have opened a door, you know?
Yeah,
he admits to a mistake this episode.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, he is all about mistakes. Made a few himself. All right, so Bernard approaches Maeve, who searches his mind to find Ford's message to her. And then Bernard finds Elsie in the garage, and Ford says he can't trust her. So Bernard tells her a half-truth, I guess, or just omits some stuff about Ford. When she asks what he found in the cradle, he says there's a system like the cradle called the Forge that they're using to turn humans into hosts, and that they need to reach it first. And we find out in this scene also that Bernard is locked out of all the systems. His thumbprint and voice print no longer work.
He did leave out the crucial, also Dr. Ford is writing him ahead detail.
Yes. That's why I say it's like a half-truth.
It's close, but it's more than... It's interesting because it's like a middle... I feel like it's a middle path between what Ford wants him to do and what Bernard wants to do, which is why I think you're supposed to understand when Bernard ejects him from a skull that that's his effort to, like, okay, fuck you, I want a authentic Bernard decision.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want any more of this trying to see what I can get away with your fucking overrides.
And it's crazy to me because the idea of, do I have a choice, and
right.
Choices make a person, is all tied up in this episode in Bernard and William.
Yeah.
And they both have very different feelings on it, I think. Like, William, when he looks for his choices, he's questioning whether he has a choice at all. Bernard is saying that he wants his own choice. They're doing something here, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, but the parallel of that idea between these two characters is interesting to me.
Right.
Maybe I'll have more insight by the time we get to the end of this.
Also, like, you know, the cradle only bigger. I doubt that we're done with cradle-style shenanigans, simulation shenanigans.
Yeah. No.
At one point, I think, well, if there are any more, there'll be flashbacks, but, like, saying that you've got a bigger, badder version of the cradle.
Yeah. How many hosts can go into it at one time?
I don't know, but like it does have me slightly weird finale because like I remember when the cradle was destroyed, we're like, oh well, this is interesting because now death actually means something, and there's one less layer of mind fuckery that they can do. They're actually placing limits on themselves. Now they're essentially retconning all that, and like, is Teddy dead? Is anyone dead? Can they any have been brought back? Is it all in Peter Abernathy's skull? Like. You know, I don't know. I mean, if I praise the decision for all those reasons, I have to somewhat criticize the fact that they're bringing back a bigger, badder version of a Deus Ex Machina device.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, like, when William gets to the cradle, is he going to see a simulation of himself running somehow?
I feel we're dangerously close with, like, Bernard opening his eyes and he's holding a snow globe that has a mesa in it, you know?
Right.
And, like... You know, I surely Nolan and Joy is smart enough to know that they can't do that. But
of course not. Yeah,
I mean,
it has consequences.
It's a wild. It's like watching him play high stakes Jenga, though, man. Because this is some really delicate shit. This is some really fragile suspension of disbelief. And the thing that's scary, if I was a showrunner, is I release this thing and I think that I've a proper and like, but then the audience starts interacting with it. And then like, it's too late to change at that point. Like you're halfway, you know,
in some cases.
So
did you see that they removed the cameraman behind Maeve from that scene?
No shit. In
they
less
went
than a
back
week
and they fixed it. Yeah.
Holy fuck. but I mean, my larger point is like, this is what Nolan and Joy thought that we would enjoy or would be interesting. And, they can be just as wrong as William, and
sure.
It's kind of too late to course correct for this season. But I'm just saying, like, I just part of the thrilling aspect of this last half of the Westworld season is just like the high stakes nature. It does feel like, man, these next couple episodes are all the marbles. So far, it's looking pretty good. Mm-hmm. Last two episodes really good, but there's still a lot hinging on the finale next week.
Yeah. All right, the Man in Black, William, questions why the righteous, upright daughter he knew would want in on the project. And she questions how they got all the cognition scans that they'd need to duplicate the guests. William reveals that the hats are the scanners. He then asks if this is about bringing back her mother, to which Emily replies that she wants to know why she did it. Not to bring her back, she just wants to know. Got a curiosity.
So the thing that I think that you have to appreciate is that Emily is putting forth a bunch of mutually incompatible theories for why she's here.
Yes.
First was to save her dad. Second was to get cut in on the deal. Third is to understand the death of their mother. It's all, I think, bullshit. And the real reason is she's there to get vengeance upon him.
Yeah, to get a confession out of
him. Right. I think that threw a lot of people because they're like, oh, like she's just like telling like all these lies. What do we know is the truth? Like,
I mean, you can look at the music box story and essentially come away with the answer because people are questioning, oh, you know, the music box, like she threw it away, so how did she find it? Did she find it? You know, why did she tell the Man in Black that, why did she tell her father that she, why did she leave that part out of the story? Well, it's to manipulate him into confession.
Mm-hmm.
Her purpose in that speech is to get him to sympathize with her and share in their mutual guilt to the point where he will confess, which if she says later
classic
on,
interrogation tactic.
Hey, she actually picked this music box back up and I found your profile in it and you're a horrible monster that drove her to suicide.
Exactly.
That doesn't work.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So she's using pieces of the truth to try and evoke a reaction.
Indeed. Indeed.
But we'll get there.
I thought it was interesting because like a lot of people pointed out that in early scenes where we see like the drones at work and the data collection procedure, that they're like above each host that they're extracting brains. There's also these translucent bins that just hold dozens of hats.
Yeah. And we saw those, right? We pointed those out in that episode.
Yeah.
But didn't understand the true nature of it.
Right. That like, yeah, these are that's the whole collection. And the fact that like it makes more sense because I've thought about it. It's like, well, Westworld is the first park, and like William said, we didn't even know what we needed at first. We need to record everything. Subsequent parks, maybe they don't need that technology anymore because it's collected every time you walk through a door or whatever. I don't that explains why hats aren't as prevalent in like maybe Samurai World or Raj World because they're later additions. But everybody was forced into the hats, and also like someone pointed out that there's a little bit of an extra seduction to Angela offering like all of this stuff is bespoke, your boots and and like this and that and your hats, pick out your hat. like there's this subtle, you know, everybody gets a hat, it's Westworld, come on, don't be an asshole, wear a hat.
Yeah,
I'll suck your dick if you wear a hat, you know, like
or if not, either way.
Right, just wear a hat. Yeah. Come on, a hat. You got to wear a hat. Like, there is a lot of, like, hat pushing in that early episode.
There is. It makes me wonder why William wears a hat, because he knows.
Yeah.
He certainly obviously knows, so.
I mean, at this point, he's already got the results and he's a psycho, so who gives a fuck, right?
It's true, yeah. His first encounter where he didn't know.
Right, right. The other thing, are you thinking what I was thinking?
He had to have known from the very beginning, though, right? He had to know that the hats were recording his every move from the very beginning, because this whole thing was his idea in the first place. Selling James Delos on the idea was part and parcel of this thing.
Yes. You are correct. Because I also saw some theories where people were like, oh, they must have like done this personality scan stuff on Logan to know he was an easy mark to fund the park. And I'm like, but whoa.
It wasn't happening before.
Exactly. Then. So I want to go back and edit all that and that, you know, maybe I don't know why. I don't know why Angela's pushing the hat so hard now.
Actually,
because it's a chicken and egg problem. Or this is the other thing is like we starting to tug the edges of the simulation, and we are going to find out that William was replaced as a host a long time ago.
When did William get that idea? Because didn't Logan bring him into the park?
No, it's between the first and second visit. Because when he helicoptered in, Logan has already been displaced and kind of disgraced.
Did we see the stuff that he did in the first visit on the profile?
No, but we did see.
William stuff.
We saw the scene of William dragging Dolores into the barn.
Yeah, that's old William.
I don't know how that appeared on that profile, that personality profile.
That's because the man in black's hat is still doing the same shit.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, is that part of his annual pilgrimage? He arrives and drags Dolores off in the exact same way to the exact same barn?
I think so, yeah.
I guess I could buy that.
I think it was clear that in Dolores's like flashbacks in the barn that like the man in black had done that many times.
Hmm. Okay. Because there's a little bit of wiggle room, but a lot of people were using that as proof that like this is all fabricated because that's a scene that we know only happened a week ago. So
I'm trying to think.
Or happened somewhere between the last fidelity check with Jim Delos and the gala.
Yeah,
which is probably way after when Juliet saw the psychological profile of her husband.
Yeah, I could talk about this all day, but let's move on.
So super, super good.
I did find it funny that as soon as he, you know, tells her about the hat, she's like, oh, God, and she takes it off. And then he says, they scan you down to your core. And she's like, puts it back on.
Right, right.
Really? You're okay with that? You didn't know you were going to die today, did you?
She just bragged to her dad about all the robots she fucked. I think she's, like, maybe over it.
Oh, yeah. They've already got that.
Plus, the mesa's on fire. Maybe she's thinking, probably not collecting data now.
All right, William and Juliet arrive home from the party, and she begins shouting about him being a phony. On seeing this, Emily decides that her mother needs to go back to rehab. William says, we'll talk about it later, and takes her upstairs to put her to bed and also to hide that card, the profile that Ford gave him, in a book. Just Slaughterhouse 5. In Westworld, Emily questions aloud what she's missing about her mother's death. And we flash back again to that night, and Emily is talking with William about committing her mother to rehab in the dining room when they see water dripping from the ceiling. William runs upstairs to find her dead in the tub.
Right. Did you see the thread about whether this is the same tub that we saw?
Oh, God, did I ever see it? Yes.
I'm like, Jesus Christ.
The double tub theory is alive.
The double tub theory is a thing.
Rub a double tub, three Juliets in a tub.
Right, and maybe one of them's a robot William.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked at it and, like, halfway down the thread, which shocked the hell out of me, someone put some pretty compelling evidence that it's the same tub, it's just different lighting and angle.
Or it's a different tub and they just had to redress the set because they...
Right.
They had different shots at different times. Like, production issues might have happened here.
Right. Like, for example, they clearly did not intend the cameraman to be filming Maeve walking down the main street of Westworld.
Right.
But yet, it was there. It is a production mistake. It does happen. They fucked up dates before. Like, it can and will happen to even shows that really sweat the details.
Like, oh shit, we didn't get the B-roll we needed.
Right. Now, I will say that there is nothing I can say absolute certainty that there isn't two separate tubs, and we're supposed to notice that because...
Right.
And it's, you're going to understand that this is, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Ram-a-lama ding-dong. But I go on Reddit if you want to see the double tub theory.
Yeah. I don't care to ever think about the double tub theory again.
Yeah, I'm actively hostile to the double tub.
I did realize how she could have seen where he put this profile card. There's that horrible bamboo mirror in the corner.
Oh, sure.
And
right.
When he's placing the card, you can see her face in it.
Right. She saw the bamboo mirror. Instantly, her eyes began to roll, and then it just landed on, like, she's like, Jesus Christ, this is he's a monster because he makes me sleep in his bamboo shit frame. So you haven't read Slaughterhouse-Five.
I haven't.
I read it.
I know it's about Billy Pilgrim, though.
You're right.
And
like
crazy timelines.
I knew about the... Because I read this book like 3 years ago. We were on our way to maybe the first... Well, like one of the Walker Stalker cons. I read it like in one long plane trip. And it really, really like amazed me and stuck with me. Like, you know, wow, this is recognizably important work. I understand why people... give it all the dap. But it is. It's about a guy named Billy Pilgrim, which is interesting because his wife says an annual pilgrimage, and he's unstuck in time, and he's kind of flashing back and forth over several different timelines. There's even some, like, weird... Like, if he is Billy Pilgrim, there's also a lot of stuff in the book where Billy gets abducted by aliens and is put inside an alien zoo, and the experience of him, like, being behind this glass and looking at his alien world is similar to, like... a host waking up in behavior.
No shit.
So of course that means William is a full-on host with two tubs.
Maybe she killed herself in one bathroom and then they moved her to a second bathroom.
Right. But I thought it's interesting that she fakes being asleep and gets this confession out of him.
Yeah.
Like I'm impressed with her being super drunk and under what's probably a powerful pharmaceutical sleep aid that she's able to. She hates him that so much that she can stave off all those effects.
Yeah, and apparently her suicide involved both pills and I think cutting her wrists.
Right. Well, I mean, she took at least one sleeping pill, which means she had access to it. And
there's a lot of blood
in the tub.
There's a bottle next to her.
Oh, okay.
The edge of the tub.
Right. But there's a lot of blood in the tub too.
Yeah. I'm not going into tub
two
theories.
Tubs worth of blood in one tub. Two tubs, one blood. I don't know.
What does it mean? All right, we're back in Westworld. William's back on the idea that Emily is a ploy from Ford, and he starts raving about burning this place down. Emily gives him the real truth, that she's pretending to care about him and is actually here to burn him down. Her mother left his profile for her to view and see the truth. Security pulls up to extract him, but William kills them all before... murdering Emily, who he believes is still a host. When he goes to open her up to prove it, he finds the profile card in her hand. And this scene is going to take about 3.5 hours to dissect properly, so set your watch.
Mm-hmm.
Skip ahead at least an hour.
Mm-hmm.
At least an hour, and we might get to the point.
Okay. You start
Here's the
then.
Thing.
Because you're right. There's like three separate attempts to determine whether fucking Emily's real, and the show stops halfway through the process on it all.
But I think there's one regard in which they go all the way.
Okay.
And I think that is the music box. Here's where I come down on this. Emily has
a heart-shaped.
Like I said before, Emily has told her father exactly what he needs to hear to try and elicit a confession from him.
Right. Or just to get him to comply so she can bring him to justice, whatever.
Right. Yeah. And so the first half of this music box story is told through Emily's dialogue. The second half of this music box story is told through the visuals, mm-hmm. what we see with Juliet. And then even by Emily herself, she said, "Mom left me the card. Mom left me your profile right. to show me who you really are."
Right.
That's the important thing here. Not like, oh, how did her mom get the music box? Why didn't Emily tell her father about it? That's not the point. The point is the episode is trying to tell us through this profile card that Emily is real.
And also that her mom and her had this backdoor, like this post-death backdoor to communicate where she like her mom was able to successfully convince her that your dad didn't love you and I loved you this whole time and tried to protect you and you thought we were disconnected, but we weren't, because I searched through the trash and got this birthday present and kept it safe, kept it close to me, and used it as a message conveyance that your father's a monster. Yeah, no, I...
Yeah, and the language of the storytelling here couldn't be more clear, in my opinion, on second and third viewings.
But if you watch it once, I can see being, like, very distracted, which I think is an intentional effect. Like, this is...
It is up until this point,
This is an expert magic trick. This is the sleight of hand. This is the, you know, pay no attention to what's going on with my left hand as it slides in my pocket, that you're supposed to be so... down the rabbit hole about whether Emily's lying or not, or if this is a discrepancy, or if she's just failed the fidelity test, that the true payload escapes you.
Yeah, there are a couple of things here that are obvious in my mind, in mm-hmm. hindsight. Like, I look at the reaction of the security guy who's scanning her. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary.
Right.
They didn't show us the green light, but nothing seemed out of the ordinary to him before he's gunned down.
But I don't think he would until it, like...
He finished the scan. He totally finished that scan.
Did he?
And he was totally cool with the result. So I don't think he saw anything. Because I watched it.
Okay.
Three times.
But what was the... I'm...
He steps away from her and looks at the scanner and then puts it away.
Oh, okay. Well, like, then, yeah.
Moments before he's gunned down.
If she was a robot, he'd be like, well, I got a robot here, you know.
Yeah.
Or maybe he'd
pull up a gun, he'd do something.
He'd start to instantly try to seduce her.
Right.
He'd start suggestively waggling his grenade-laden hips in her direction.
He's not a purpose-built machine for seduction.
Right.
Or maybe he is. I don't know what he's like in the bedroom, but... He definitely thought she was a human. Here's the other thing.
Yeah.
The whole point of having the man in black say, there are only two people in this world who know about my profile, me and Ford.
You're right.
Is to immediately prove him wrong when he finds this card in her hand.
Right.
That's the whole point of that scene.
If she is a robot, then Ford could now, like, you start getting into...
Right, but I'm talking about storytelling. I'm talking about storytelling here. I'm not talking about, like... what could or couldn't be. What they're trying to convey to you is that we know where this card was last.
Right.
And if you're talking about two cards, then they're just fucking with us. And that's not interesting. That's reducing later on the emotional impact of this scene, which should be devastating to William.
Yes.
There's no hint that there are ever two cards in this episode.
Let me ask you this, because I guess... does the emotional payload... depend on William being a real person too, or does it work if he's a host?
I think it works if he's a host.
Because, like, that was the thing I was going to challenge you, because I think you get way too ahead of yourself if you want to have that and then say, like, well, if you're a robot, it doesn't matter.
No, it matters just as much as Teddy killing himself does to Dolores.
But, like, I just want to say what I, because I want to play devil's advocate myself, don the satanic lawyer suit, and say that. If I'm a person arguing the other side on r/Westworld, I would say that, yes, it is them fucking with us, but it's super possible that Ford could produce this card and this android daughter.
Possible, but everything the episode is telling us is exactly the opposite.
Right.
Exactly. If you trace this card,
I'm just trying to articulate the argument.
I know. I'm arguing at this fictional Redditor, right? Like,
right. Which is like,
Redditor, but this fictional theorizer.
And if you want to say that, like, it's implausible, then, like, you know, there's a lot of things like the Joker does in the Dark Knight that is implausible, but yet Nolan wrote it, and you don't really notice it unless you watch it a couple times. So, like, I can see where people are looking for the sleight of hand and looking for the, like...
Absolutely, you can't and be like, I was the first time around. Yeah.
Right, right. So I think we've covered both sides of that pretty good. And anything else we... Because we're it's much less than 3 hours have elapsed, and I feel like we're getting towards the end. I mean, the quotes that we haven't, like, really talked about was, like... You know, it's interesting. She says, I'm your daughter pretending to give a shit about you. That's a very ambiguous statement that could imply that, you know, she's also says to her father that you are in your very essence a lie. But the other thing is like this is a crossing a Rubicon moment, because I do believe this is the first time William has actually shed actual blood.
Yeah, if you don't consider the host, as he probably doesn't, to be alive.
Right.
But certainly at the times he killed them.
Right. And to me, this, like he does it in, like, this moment of fury and ends up killing...
And delusion,
yeah. Right. Now, the one thing I want to say is, like, that I don't know if they're going to play with this or not, but, like, his daughter says, I'm going to bring you, and I'm going to reveal your secrets, and I'm going to bring you down and lock you up. Mm-hmm. And she has I think she thinks that this, like, psychological profile is going to be the key. I crunched some numbers, and if this personality type is the rarity that they say it is, and assuming there's still 7 billion people on the planet, which is not a safe assumption in 30 years from now, but there'd be something like 50 million people in the world that have this personality type. Like, it seems rare until you start talking about billions of people. And the other interesting thing is, like, this is the classic that there's been a lot of literature of late that says that essentially almost every president or CEO has this type of personality. And I'm wondering, like, what the real world would have to say about something like this. Like if Delos is trying to take over the world, it would be interesting if, like, all these rich, powerful people have essentially the same archetype. And there is support for that in, like, you know, studies and whatnot. And it's something I was turning over in my head. Like, if they're trying to make a point that, like, William is a rich and powerful CEO and he's a psychopath, but then so are most rich and powerful CEOs.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the only other person we have in that position, well, we have two people, I suppose, James Delos and Ford himself.
Right, and they're all somewhat on the crazy spectrum, I'd say.
Certainly at points in their life, yeah.
Right.
I mean, James Delos pretty much all the way.
Right.
Ford had a change of heart.
Yeah, but still Ford, to fully embody the godhood that he is, that is... That's just delusional. That is delusional. Like, that's reading your own press. Like, just because you've created a race of sentient beings does not mean you're God, dude. But he is kind of, like, really playing that up. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, I'm comfortable saying he's delusional. He might be a good guy. He might be very powerful. He might be mostly right. But, like, anytime you start saying, I'm a God, like, you know, you're at least John Lennon levels of delusional.
Sure. I do think that Man in Black has to burn this place to the ground now, because he's got the hat on recording all of these human murders.
Sure.
He could be in some real trouble, like actual real trouble.
Yeah, he's committed murder most foul.
Yes.
This is an actual crime. I think we all agree.
So he's got to burn this place down now.
Yes.
All right, Ford appears to Maeve and tells her how much she meant to him as his favorite host, and he tried to guide her out to safety, but that was a mistake on his part. He tells her not to let the humans end her here, and then she, or potentially he, unlocks her core permissions, or some kind of core permissions. It's ambiguous whether it's within her or within the park, the park systems. I'm not sure.
Yeah. She's either unlocking her ultimate hidden super badass abilities, or she's also getting God mode for the park. I think the result is going to be the same.
I would think so. Yeah.
Like, she can effortlessly rewrite host behavior, like, on a scale that's even more impressive than before. She can have unlock all of her core attributes. Like, who the hell knows? But, like, I think it's going to essentially allow her to, I don't know, cause a stampede of cattle to go through the halls of Westworld.
Sure.
At least,
like, that
bare minimum. She might be able to stop bullets. Who knows? I mean, literally, she could. These bullets are still manufactured in Friend or Fire. She could just... There's a brief scene of her kind of like holding up her hand Neo style in the preview for next week.
Just
like,
saying no.
She could just, yeah, I mean, I'm assuming she could just turn all those rounds to be whatever, like clay pigeons or I don't know.
Yeah.
We could see some real freaky deaky stuff next week.
Sounds awesome. I like this scene here. We talked about it a bit in the intro, but with Ford telling her, you stayed in this world to save your child, and so have I. It's a very touching scene.
Did you see in Reddit that someone had pointed out that, like, Anthony Hopkins has a daughter that he's estranged from?
Yeah, but I've also heard he doesn't really care. Like, there have been interviews with him where he's like, yeah, I don't really know anything about my child or grandchildren, and I don't really care.
Well,
like I'm okay with how everything has turned out, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what's like. I don't have a hat on him that's reading his thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I can imagine that would be a well to draw from.
Exactly. Like to me, like I was really impressed by like you know how powerful a moment that was, and then I read that. I'm like, well, that makes sense if he can draw on like a tenth of that.
Yeah.
That actual pain, and I understand like if someone. You know, like I wouldn't take it too kindly if somebody surprised me with some kind of bullshit about my former in-laws in the middle of an interview or something. Like, and I'd probably give a pretty flip answer that's not. But yeah, I don't know.
Or at some point,
but also it's called acting. At some point, you don't have to, you know, experience everything in life to be able to portray it. You know,
right?
You can find the like emotion, like maybe when.
Although he is also a serial killer,
he's drawing that time where his roommate in college ate the last burrito in the freezer, and the tears rolling down his cheek. Like, who knows? Who knows? It's just interesting. It's interesting that he has gone through something like this.
Yeah, and at some point he had to contemplate it and feel something about it. So you'd think.
Right.
So I found it interesting here that this is the scene where he admits the mistake, right? That he shouldn't have charted a path for Maeve so much as opened a door.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because it's a similar mistake to the one that Arnold made. And I feel like he made this mistake. It's strange because he makes this mistake with Maeve, but he seemingly doesn't make this mistake with Dolores, right? He says, like, I knew what she would do, kind of, but I gave her the choice to do it. He didn't program her to do that. Whereas we saw with Maeve, he actually sat down and wrote the code to program her to leave.
Right.
So, charting her path, why did he do these two very incongruous things to two different hosts at the same time?
Well, there's always an opportunity he's not exactly telling the truth about the stuff with the what he did to Dolores. And now, like, I'm also wondering if, like, because we've, several times the baton has been, as a protagonist, has been handed back and forth, and I can kind of see where you're going to go down this line that, like, in season three, you'll come to understand that Maeve is the one that had, like, the artificial fake freedom, and Dolores is the one that was making all of her own decisions, and that's why her plot is messier and less cinematic and maybe less, you know, it's more angsty, angry teenager and less, you know, mature wealth, because it's not as scripted, maybe. I'm somewhat annoyed. Because, like, I can see how you could just flip that back and forth in six seasons and in the end be like, what did we learn? Mind blown. And I don't know. I forget where I was going with that. I think I just need to stop talking because I think I made my point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, he has admitted to a mistake in this scene. That could also have been his mistake to, you know,
over-engineer.
Maybe he realized that, you know, he programmed her, Maeve, and then said, oh, well, maybe that's not the way to go, or maybe this is an A-B test, maybe this is like, I'll program one of them to get out, and then I'll let the other do what I think they need to do to get to their own conclusion.
What did he mean by, he said, at some point I thought the only way to survive this world is to laugh, and I imbued my host that I made with a worldview that reflected my own? What is the point of that?
None of these people are laughing.
No, but they do None have, like, Maeve has always had some of the best, like, bon mots.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm wondering if, like, this is a criticism, like, a lot of criticism last year was, like, everyone speaks in these Shakespearean crazy ass monologues and thought, well, if they were all imbued with the Anthony Hopkins, you know, Dr. Ford spirit, that would explain why they do speak like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can like chart a difference between the host created by Ford versus the horse, the horses created by.
I mean, they also, yes, they're a horse
sure.
host.
For Arnold, and then like the vulgar ones that are like Rebus, like that's a Lee guy.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a Lee guy,
oh,
right?
That's definitely Lee.
So like, I wonder if you could like chart a course and figure out who built who. Like,
yeah,
it's interesting though, because like that would imply that Bernard, you know, Arnold built Dolores, so Dolores shouldn't do that.
Have those kind
she
of...
She certainly doesn't seem yeah. like she has a sense of humor.
No.
Her and Teddy, one of maybe things. Those are Arnold creations.
Yeah.
They're much more dour.
Arnold had a flair for the dramatic, I
less,
guess.
Less devil may care.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's...
I do find that William and Dolores going the exact opposite direction, you know, with their children, essentially,
mm-hmm.
is interesting, because he, you know, he talks about coming in here and saving his child. William and Dolores kill their children. You know, Teddy is the creation of Dolores at this point.
Mm-hmm.
She drove him to kill himself at the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
William literally killed his daughter. They're just like monsters, in my opinion. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's...
And whether or not they'll change their ways after realizing that is, I think, the question. But,
yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty horrible. All right. We move on to Bernard and Elsie. They stop to collect ammo from some dead bodies when Ford tries to convince Bernard to kill Elsie. He decides to handcuff himself to the steering wheel of the buggy, and he deletes Ford from his head. Question mark. Bernard decides to leave Elsie and gives her a transponder so that QA can find her, and he drives away. This seems all too easy to delete Ford, right?
Oh, yeah.
I also question why later on in the timeline, as we know it, he would be defragging his head so severely.
Mm-hmm.
During the interrogations with Hale, if Ford weren't still in there.
There's more to come. No way.
Yeah.
No way it was easy.
Ford won't go
easy.
Out like that. No.
Right, right.
He's still in there. He's lurking.
Yeah. I do wish that they had let Elsie react a little bit naturally to this. Because, like, the end of the scene is her being discomforted by how weird Bernard is acting. And Ford abandons her. With probably a bucket and some protein bars.
Yeah.
We'll see you in mid-season 3, Elsie.
But she'll be looking better than
she'll
ever.
She'll be looking better than yeah. ever, right. But, oh, shit. I got to distract myself with my own joke. I wish that, like, because how far away did she get from Bernard? And Bernard's literally screaming, get out of my fucking head!
Yeah.
And it would work so much better if she had, like, come up sprinting. Like, what the hell is going on? And, like... Just, I don't need much, man. Just a little bit of acknowledgement of, like, how weird this is.
Yeah.
You know? This is,
yeah.
But this, again, like, every host-human interaction feels weird and off to me. Like, it's that needs some tune-up. That definitely, like, anytime humans are planning against hosts or hosts are planning against humans, they just need to tighten that shit up. Because, not fatal, but I would have much more enjoyed this scene if she had done that. Because the whole time it's happening, I'm like, how is she strolling up nonchalantly? Yeah, didn't find any ammo on the ground. Oh, you're handcuffed to the...
Right.
Like, yeah.
Heard somebody screaming, though. I don't know what
exactly,
that was all about.
Exactly, exactly.
So...
Or maybe not have Bernard scream, get out of my fucking head. Like, either or.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Do a mind scream. Just show him screaming that in his own head.
Maybe that's what happened.
Without moving his mouth.
Maybe this is a time where he was on a loop and he was driving the dune buggy and he didn't have
right.
Elsie. What do you make of it? So you spent some time thinking about this concept of Tim Shell.
I did, but real quick before we get to that,
okay.
Because that'll probably be a discussion. We clearly haven't seen the end of Elsie, right? She's going to pop up somewhere.
She's going to pop up mid-season 3 with a bucket and protein bars and flawless
no,
makeup.
Do you have any
real surely.
Guesses as to where she's going to pop up? Is she going to hook up with security and head toward
the
valley?
I keep going back to what Bernard says, is if anybody can fix this with sheer force of will, it's
yeah.
you. Like, that implies that she has a greater... But then that's me saying that every line of dialogue has to drip with meaning.
Right.
That could just be something Bernard said to give her a shot in the arm and didn't really mean. Or he's wrong. Like, but to me, I think it's better storytelling to have that pay off.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like she is very much a minor character in the end game here. Like, this is going to be a three-way confrontation between Maeve, Dolores, and William. They seem like they've made that very clear in this final episode about the great... And probably...
I think it's going to be more of a shit Akita. Show. The humans...
You got Akita in there, too.
Yeah. I think Elsie could be important. Because
right.
Bernard has clearly not had the point... He's not been pushed to the point where he has to make a choice.
Yeah.
He's made the easy choice right now,
right.
which is to... leave Elsie and not have to deal with her.
Right.
At some point, I think there needs to come a choice between helping the host escape or doing something righteous and killing Elsie.
Or this is like the because Ford keeps on saying she'll betray you. She's inevitably going to betray you.
Right.
She's like, maybe this is Ford trying to like have the host disprove or prove this hypothesis. Like, maybe there are humans that are open-minded enough that
absolutely, yeah,
they will, like, I see you as a real person and a friend. I don't give a shit what anybody else thinks. I'm going to help you. Like,
I know there
and these hosts need those types of humans to have any kind of shot in the world.
Right.
So I think that maybe her role will be a human that they can trust.
But I do think
or maybe
they're
she'll
really
be a sacrificial-
stressing this idea of choice, right? This Tim Shell thing is tied so deeply into that. So Tim Shell, I guess when he says Tim Shell, thou mayest, he's talking about a choice that Bernard needs to make between sinning and not sinning,
right.
essentially. But that's like the larger context of it from Genesis, I guess, when God is talking to Cain.
Right before he murders Abel.
Right before he murders Abel. It's about the offering that they both brought, and God respects Abel's offering, doesn't respect Cain's, and then Cain goes off the rails and he's all distraught, and God's
God is trying to say, he's like, this is, it's your heart condition, you're full of jealousy and hatred, and like, if you don't watch
out,
and
you have a choice over that,
like, sin is crouching at the door ready to overtake you, but
and
it's
thou,
up to you,
thou mayest, you know, thou mayest rule over you,
right,
which also implies thou mayest not rule over
you, that this is, it's not a fate, it's not inevitability. It's something that Cain needs to struggle with.
Right. And that,
spoiler
that
alert,
is,
he doesn't.
Right. Well, it may end badly for Elsie, because that's the exact point that Ford is making to Bernard. He has a choice to make here, you know? And I don't think his choice to make was leave Elsie behind to be saved or not.
Well, there's also...
His choice is going to be much more difficult.
If I want to talk about your favorite literary device, the Christ figure...
yes. Did Jesus handcuff himself to a steering wheel?
He did. I know Jesus was a Honda man, because him and his apostles always were in one accord.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
But,
Jesus Christ.
Shit. Again, I got distracted by my own joke. I think that it would be interesting if Elsie has to die as the one innocent human that just wanted good things for all the hosts, to like redeem humanity in the host eyes. Like, if she ends up dying to save the host, to like put an exclamation point on Bernard, Maeve, Dolores, some common Akichita, that oh shit, not all of these are death or are monsters, and also probably not all of the hosts are angels.
Sure. In a similar way to perhaps Emily needing to die to show
William. And if I were to be bold, I would say the bulk of the remaining seasons of this show are going to wrestle with that question.
Yeah.
Not all humans are devils. Not all hosts are angels.
The bulk of the remaining of this season?
The seasons.
Okay.
Because
I'm like, it's almost over, man.
That's a lot of story to unpack.
It is. But it's interesting stuff. So let's move on to William stopping in a field, putting a gun to his head as we flash back to him telling Juliet the truth about the darkness inside him. He confesses that he belongs to Westworld, not to her or this world. And when he leaves, Juliet finds the card he hid and views his profile. Horrified, she hides it in her music box. And then William's voiceover questions whether he has choices at all, whether those choices make him up. Meanwhile, he's decided not to shoot himself, and he digs into his arm with a knife, presumably to check whether he's a host.
You said that it was Juliet's music box. It's actually Emily's, right?
I mean,
possession,
possession
ninth
is
the law. Okay.
Yeah,
okay. But
so
I just
in that
make,
moment, it's Juliet's.
This
but
is confusing. I want to make sure we don't further confuse people.
This is the same music box that Emily is talking
there
about.
There you
yes.
go. There you go.
There's a lot of stuff in that we see in William's profile that we could talk about here. There's a lot of symbolism, themes. Where do you want to start?
I feel like
the profile, it's the easiest to dig into, I guess.
Why?
Because it shows a couple of things. A, he's subject number two.
Yeah, okay.
Which
true,
I think is interesting. I'm assuming that James Daedalus is subject number one.
It just depends on what this means. Is it the first person? So we know for a fact that there's no way William can be the second person in Westworld. Because there's multiple, unless that's literally the first train back after Logan has reopened the park. But Logan's been many, many times. We see lots of guests fucking around in the park. So, like, to me,
I think you're
the only other number two it could be is, like, replacement. That he's, they could have slid by the fact that William is a host right underneath our noses here.
Yeah, and I mean, if this is a quest for immortality, think about who would want it the most, right?
Sure.
James Daedalus, he's dying. He actively needs immortality. He needs this project to succeed. He's host number one. Number two would be, you know, the next most important person in line,
right?
Who's searching for immortality, William. Seems logical.
Why would he want it? That's my big question is, does William know?
I guess why wouldn't you? If you could get the ability to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose most people would, on the surface of it, say, yes, give me that.
Yeah, I guess. But why would that be the second? Like, why would you subject yourself to be the second? I know how.
Because there's no cost in it, really, right?
No, like, there's not. But
just go to Westworld, wear this hat, you're good.
William didn't seem like he was a big fan of the project, but then that's at the end of
his
life.
But that changed, yeah.
Okay.
That changed over the years, like Ford did.
I guess you're right. But that, I completely reject that number one is Logan, number two is William, just because I don't think that works out.
Yeah, I agree. And then we see some of the personality traits of William here. There's delusions, paranoid subtype, and
persecution complex.
The one I found interesting is the persecutory subtype.
Mm-hmm.
So he views himself as a victim in mm-hmm. this whole situation. Strange to me.
That matches his previous, like, that he wants to appeal this judgment he got. Like, he feels aggrieved by Ford. Like, you've wrongly mischaracterized me. And I think this is the verdict that he's appealing.
I was going to ask you who you thought was judging him.
Okay.
Yeah, Ford.
I think this is the verdict that he's rebelling against, this persecution, delusional, paranoid thing. That he's like, this is not me.
Right. So there's a little detail here that I think contributes to how you should understand this final scene with William
mm-hmm.
of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
There, when he has the gun to his head, there's a fly that lands on his hat. And we understand, and it's an accompanying sound effect and everything.
Yep.
It's not just like, oh, some random fly on the set.
Uh-huh.
This was intentional. It was given a sound effect.
Right.
You know? This is always associated with awakenings in hosts. And I don't want to say, like, oh, he's definitely a host here. What I want to say is this is an awakening for him.
You're right.
He has understood that he was the cause of Juliet's death. Now that he knows she had seen his profile, this guilt that he feels, I think, is stronger than ever. And now he's turning to whatever he can grasp to continue.
Right.
I think that is reflected in him searching himself, like, am I a host?
Yeah.
Do I have my choices that were my own that I made that caused this, or was I programmed this way?
Right. And I think the real question...
Because that could absolve him, you know? He's looking for something to absolve himself.
And the way he rubbed his arm, like, I wonder if, like, this has been something that he does on a fairly regular basis. Like, I just need to check that I'm real. Because I keep... Every time I go to the park, I feel like, you know... But the thing that I think the William might not know is that, well, he should, that the human host bodies maybe not have a USB port in the armpit of their arm. What do you call that? Is it called the ditch?
Sure.
I heard, like, tattoo people
tract.
Call it the ditch.
The tract.
Yeah.
I don't know, because that's where you inject.
Yeah, it's the tract.
Yeah.
There's just got to be a word for the reverse of your elbow. The backside of
the back of your elbow.
The front of your elbow.
Yeah.
Like the back of the knee, that's what you call it. It's the front of the elbow. I mean, that's the thing I keep coming back is, like, these human bodies have to be fully indistinguishable from real human bodies or the jig would be up. But we also know that the show has definitely told us that's not going to happen because they have these marbles inside their head.
Right.
So
they could very well have the jacks.
So I wonder the other, but we also know that hosts are programmed to not see things they're not supposed to see. So it could be that William digs in his arm and there's like the USB outlet, but he just doesn't. It doesn't look like anything to him.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's like one of those things where like someone has told him that like the other Christopher Nolan, the other Nolan work, Inception, he's got this totem that he can always check, but he can't. But I mean, that's the thing. Like, as he's holding a gun to his head and there's this voiceover saying, were any of these choices ever mine to begin with? And as he starts digging his arm, his wife's words echoing, is this real? Are you real? Like, to me, it was shocking that they end up leaving ambiguous, which almost is enough to make me think that he's probably not a robot.
Yeah,
he's probably not a host, which is amazing because I was full on board. The fact that they've got me back on my heels a little bit is bravo.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think in this episode, it's not as important as the fact that he's questioning it. You know?
Yeah.
Because that's the point here. Looking for that absolution.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, like, you know, speaking of, like, you know, Garden of Eden type issues where he says, what is a person but a collection of choices, but where do those choices come from? Like, that's something I always had problems with when I was, you know, a practicing Christian. Like, why drop your child? Like, when I brought a child into the world, I put fucking foam rubber over all the sharp edges. I put stuff in the outlet so he couldn't stick a butter knife in there. I watched him like a hawk and guided him. God essentially puts us in a room with a live wire and says, if you eat this thing that you can eat and there's nothing preventing you from doing it, you're going to fucking die.
Yeah.
Have fun, kids. Like... You know, yeah, choices define you, but you don't get to choose your choices. You don't get to choose what you're born into. You don't get to choose your environment. So, like, you know, a lot of this, well, you are the choices you make, is kind of some bullshit. Because, you know, going back to the first, none of us chose to be born. So fuck everything.
Fuck you, Ford.
Right.
I didn't choose to be born.
Let's just read Nishi for the rest of the podcast and you know, figure some shit out.
I do think that the idea, the Tim Shell word here plays in an interesting way, because as I understand it from reading the works of people who have researched this for years, this single word and what it means in context, God is essentially saying that one of the fundamental things being human is having the choice to sin or not.
Right.
And in that regard, the Man in Black is essentially questioning the very thing that makes him human, which I think is delicious in the context of, you know, potentially also being a host as he's digging into his arm.
Right.
He's saying, do I have any choice at all?
Right.
Well, if you're human, you know, the Bible would say, yes, you do. Right. You most certainly do.
And that's the Christian response to the tree of good, the knowledge of good and evil, is that it had to be there or else.
Sure, yeah.
You know, how would you sin against God? Violate natural law? Like, disobey gravity? Like, yeah. if you had no way to express a rebellion against him, then... But
sure.
I don't know. I didn't find the answer satisfying, and thus here I am.
All right, we got one more juicy scene to talk about.
Yes.
Teddy and Dolores stop at this just really ramshackle building. Mm-hmm. Teddy begins pondering who he was made to be and how that factors into who he is today. And his love for Dolores is his cornerstone. He remembers seeing her for the first time when he was activated and he saw her in the lab. It's all so sweet. But it immediately turns dark when Teddy decides he can't live with the changes that Dolores has made to him and blows his brains out right in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
And Dolores screams, a silent scream.
I thought it was interesting how they had the choice to make Dolores be kind of threatening at the end. Like, you don't want to hurt. Like, the fact that she couldn't conceive that the rebellion would be because of the man she made him, not like that he's trying to usurp her authority or whatever. Like that that's how powerful the cornerstone is.
Yeah, and I hope that this is the moment that really drives home to her what Maeve said. You know, all the times that Maeve has said, you're forcing them down the path that you have prescribed, which is funny because that's what Ford tried to do to her,
right?
To Maeve. I hope that finally kicks in, you know, in Dolores.
What is Dolores's cornerstone? And also, like, I guess the thing, because like,
I thought it was like her father, her relationship with her father.
Yeah, but I thought they maybe even addressed this, like, that she has this kind of like generic love for humanity and like this optimism,
the natural splendor.
Yeah, and like that there's a conflict between that and like Wyatt's cornerstone.
Mm-hmm.
And like that now she's going to have to like authentically, like, you know, Teddy didn't have a choice. This was his solution to try to plot a course between his loyalty and love for Dolores and his repulsion at the man that he's made her. And the fact that, you know, he can't be disloyal to her and spare all these people. And also, like, I think there's also a little bit of horror of like, well, the last time I disobeyed her command to commit senseless carnage, she turned me into this.
Yeah.
Holy shit, what's the next stop if she gets mm-hmm. a chance? Like, there might be a little bit of that fatalism. But I don't know. It really worked for me, and her performance sold it.
Yeah.
Like, and how, like, she did, she's like, she had to confront everything about, like, how one-sided the power in their relationship was, and how, you know, Arnold told her that, like, what's real is what cannot be replaced, and now she thinks that Teddy is irreplaceable, and she's just mm-hmm. she's devastated, and it's too late. It's too late to fix things.
Yeah.
That's genuine moment of loss that I suspect is going to be undone because Teddy can come back and everybody can come back.
But, from the Forge, yeah.
But we'll see. Before we get to feedback, this week's episode of our podcast is sponsored by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/Westworld and browse an unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a free title and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/Westworld or text Westworld to 500-500 to get started today. So we talked about, like, to have the unmatched selection of audiobooks, and not just books. It's original audio shows, news, comedy programming from the leading sources and publishers and broadcasters, all in one easy, convenient place. The other cool thing about Audible is it allows you to listen to more books by letting you switch seamlessly between devices, picking up exactly where you left off. That's what I like about it. I can be reading the book on my Kindle, put it on my nightstand, wake up in the morning, start my commute, and call it up on my podcast and have it start reading the book to me. It's all handled by the WhisperSync technology. And you can get through a lot of those books by doing almost anything. It's summertime. Mm-hmm. You know, we just had a listener talk about, well, no, we're before the feedback section. We're about to have a listener talk about listening to our podcast while they're running.
Yeah.
Like, if you're running, you're biking, kayaking, make sure your device is in a nice waterproof bag, at the beach, mowing your lawn. There's so many ways to enjoy summertime activities and not just have your brain go off into mush or listen to music or whatever. Like, you know, edify yourself, get in a book. And right now they're offering our listeners a 30-day trial to get their first audiobook free. I'd like to make a recommendation. It's probably going to be no surprise. It's something I've been talking about all season. The Sapiens. Speaking of an inception, my God. This thing got into my ear through an Alt-Shift-X Audible ad. And now I've recommended it once. I'm going to recommend it again. It's just, the Westworld's about a time on the planet where two intelligent Sapien creatures are existing at the same time, and we think that's a unique situation, but this book actually reveals that in humanity's primordial past that there were multiple humans, types of humans walking around. You had Neanderthals, you had Homo sapiens. How did they coexist? How did they compete? Why is there only one left? What would it be like if there was more than that? This is stuff that's explored in the Book of Sapiens, what it means to be human, what it means to be consciousness, the consciousness revolution that took place 70,000 years ago, where modern cognition first developed. And like, that's kind of a cool thing to think about, too. Like, what if you're the first human that discovered cognition?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you seem like a crazy person to people? Like, that's probably like the first shaman or the first like priest is the ones that kind of put these puzzles together. What was that like? It's fascinating stuff. And if you've read Sapiens, he has a follow-up, this Dr. Harari, Homo Deus. he plays around this concept of Innosapiens, like, here is all of human evolution, what might humans evolve to next? And Homo Deus, which I haven't started yet, but I'm excited to, is all about that second part. Mm. Like, what do we evolve to beyond Homo sapien? Check it out. Again, you can get a free trial and get your first audiobook free. Could be Sapiens. Go to audible.com/Westworld or text Westworld to 500-500. This podcast is also sponsored, as always, by Bald Move itself. You can support us directly by going to club.baldmove.com. There's a lot of incentives to do so, not just that you're supporting this independent content, but we try to, you know, try to make it worth your while. This week we're doing something special. We're going to live watch the original Westworld on the website, baldmove.com. You'll watch us watch the movie, and you can follow along with your personal copy, or you can just listen to what we have to say, or you can interact with it however you want. And it's also, it's called a live watch, but it's recorded for posterity, so if you can't make the live watch, you can always just watch it whenever. Maybe we should call it the anytime watch.
It doesn't have the ring.
It's recorded live,
yeah,
but then might be rebroadcast at a future date of your choosing. But you can go to club.baldmove.com, check out the pitch, sign up if you want. There's example content of all that stuff, including live watches. You can check out a couple live watches probably of, what, The Walking Dead, I'm sure?
Probably.
If you just want to see how it kind of works. But you can sample a lot of that content for free, and also 30-day free trial just by going to club.baldmove.com. Hope to see you. I should mention that it's Wednesday, next tomorrow night. Wednesday, June 20th, is when we're doing the live watch at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard if you want to watch it truly live. But again, you know, whatever. You want to watch on a weekend, want to watch it next week, want to watch it a year from now, it's always there as a club member, club.baldmove.com.
That's it for the episode.
Yeah.
That's all I've got. Do we have some feedback for sure.
Mike, first up, westworld@baldmove.com is where you send feedback. Just want to let everybody know that. We also have forums, forums.baldmove.com. Mike D has one minor correction from the past podcast. There's actually a couple of commentaries on the past podcast. You guys have listened to several of these. I think you know how it goes. Aaron mentioned the American Indians stayed hunter-gatherers longer than many other peoples. But actually, most American Indians of North America turned to agriculture more than 1,000 years before Columbus. The primary crop was corn, obviously, but they cultivated a number of other foods throughout the continent. As a result, they formed towns in many places. At its peak, he says, this Cahoyca town in Illinois was estimated to have a population of 40,000. Which you can't do that without agriculture.
Longhouses.
An interesting deviation from this path, though it may relate to Westworld, is the Plains tribes. The American Indians of the Plains region of now United States had also largely become agriculturists by the time of Columbus' arrival. It's also important to remember that there were no horses in the American continent until 1519, and they were not used by American Indians until the early 1700s.
Life found a way.
They only brought female horses to the New World just to keep them from breeding, but they started fucking frogs, and the rest is fake history. Once it began to be used, the Plains tribes found the horses gave them an opportunity for a much easier lifestyle. They could depend almost exclusively on buffalo. They actually chose to move, in scare quotes, backwards in the eyes of some anthropologists by returning to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Hmm. As Aaron alluded to, this gave them much more free time to actually develop artistically, and their relatively easy lifestyle is what Akichita describes at the beginning of the episode. You are, of course, correct, and I was chagrined to get the correction because, like, shit, like, of all the stupid shit I was taught in grade school, one of the things that they did teach us was it was, in fact, the, you know, Native Americans' understanding of agriculture to help the pilgrims to survive. And that led to the first Thanksgiving. And, you know, probably a lot of simplified bullshit. But even I should have remembered that. They always say it's like they just bury a dead fish with the corn seed, right? That was the secret that they taught the pilgrims. You got to put a dead fish in with the corn to make it grow, you dumbass. Don't you know anything about maize? Okay. Moving on, Vince C., a meta point I'd like to make that I haven't seen anyone else point out. It's about the casting of the Native American actors, specifically that all of the accredited Native American roles are played by real Native American actors, with the exception of the new Kohana. This seems pretty fitting, as if to point out how poor of a replacement the new Kohana is. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Hmm.
Mike W., I mostly listen to your podcast while I'm running, which gives me a lot of time to think. Lately, you've been talking about some of your disappointments of season two content, especially the action sequences and the somewhat hokey storytelling devices used on occasion. But an episode like Kikusuya airs, and we're all back to loving the show again, and I'm right there with you. Kikusuya felt nostalgic to me, like putting on a warm pair of Westworld socks. It seemed, which read your feet. They
let you breathe, though.
You slip those socks on, they make a highly detailed 3D model of your feet.
That Ford's going to pleasure himself to later.
Somehow your brains run through your feet, and they didn't know what they needed, so they recorded it all. Seemed like to return to what Westworld had been doing great all along. This got me thinking about the stark contrast between an episode like Kikusuya and other episodes that we've seen this season, and then I donned my tinfoil hat. I'm becoming more and more convinced that this contrast is intentional, that we're supposed to feel it, and we're supposed to love an episode like Kikusuya, and perhaps even cringe a little at seemingly ill-conceived action sequences and plot devices used elsewhere. Let's shift gears into the greater Nolan theory. In Christopher Nolan's Inception, the movie can be watched a couple of different ways. On one hand, it's a trippy mindfuckery story about incepting ideas into people's heads through dreams. These dreams can be layered. The deeper you dream, the more susceptible you are to the inception. The film can be enjoyed at this surface level. But if you go a little deeper and listen to interviews from Nolan himself, you'll see that there's an intentional allegory. The film is the dream. It's an allegory for filmmaking itself at a meta level. We, the audience, are receiving an inception of Nolan's ideas. The characters are a film crew. Cobb is the director, Arthur a producer, and so on. We, the audience, are the dreamers. I didn't even know this. The first letters of the main characters' names are an anagram for the word dreams. Don, Robert, Ames, Arthur, Mal, Sato. So let me skip ahead to this film analysis. With that in mind, let's shift back to Jonathan the Lesser Nolan. In Season 1, Episode 2, Chestnut, one of my favorites, Ford replies to Sizemore's garish new storyline pitch with a quote that has been fully lodged in my head for the last week or two. It's not about giving you guess what they think they want. That's simple. The titillation, horror, elation, they're parlor tricks. The guests don't return for the obvious things we do, the garish things. They come back because of the subtleties, the details. They come back because they discover something they imagine no one has ever noticed before, something they've fallen in love with. They're not looking for a story that tells them who they are. They already know who they are. They're there because they want a glimpse of who they could be. He continues, if we think in terms of Westworld, the show being a theme park, then we are guests and Ford could just as well be talking about us. We're not here for the obvious things, the garish things. No, we're here for the subtleties and the details. We've come back for things we've fallen in love with. Kikusuya is a great reminder of what we've fallen in love with, and it's a direct contrast to the more obvious things we've seen on occasion in Season 2. So he's convinced that this is intentional, that we're supposed to see this kind of rhythm and it's supposed to fully tie back into the themes of Westworld. And this is kind of a meta thing about audiences and producers. Yeah. And what do you think about that?
I see where he's coming from. And call me simple. Call me a Lee.
Simple Lee.
But I want the things that make me enjoy watching a show.
Right.
Yes, I understand that sometimes you need to transcend that. Yeah. And you can do that. But if you... And I guess, you know, Westworld is succeeding in walking that line because I'm not ready to turn Westworld off.
Yeah.
I am looking for some of those simpler Lee-like things from Westworld to keep me engaged on, you know, an emotional level when maybe mentally some of the other stuff is doing it for me. But, yeah, it can be both, I assume, right, is what he's saying here, and I guess I agree with that.
I mean, it got me, because as I mentioned on Instant Talk podcast, I've been trying to think about ways where, because I don't think Nolan, much less Joy, are stupid, obvious people that write bad things. Like, Jonathan Nolan has written some of the more clever things that him and his brother have collaborated on, and they're very interesting and intellectually satisfying. But I do think the line between something that working and not working is pretty narrow. Like, I think, like, what if Inception was 10% less well done? Mm-hmm. Like, we'd probably be talking about what a pretentious piece of, like, people do talk about the movie that way. It's not universally loved, but, like, more people would be like, well, this is a pretentious piece of shit. People don't usually say, ooh, this is a very ambitious but flawed project. It's always, this is awesome or this is trash, right?
Of course.
And I feel like that is in full throttle on the places where you discuss Westworld. Like, season two isn't like an occasional disappointment that has a scratch in your head. It's just a shit. It's just the storytelling and the writing are just way shittier compared to this. When in reality, it could be like Inception, just 10% of it works less well than it needed to for the spell to work. And I think like I guess what I'm going for is like I've been trying to think like maybe some of this stuff, like the fact that William is a psychopath, is an indictment of the leadership that we have agreed to allow to be put over us here on planet Earth, that the incompetence of Delos is a statement on corner cutting and lack of a transparency in accounting and corporate culture. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm willing to admit that and admire the audacity of the ideas and perhaps the plan, but also say that the execution leaves a little to be desired.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, like, you know, I would like to try to shape the criticism. Now, there's sometimes where the floor just falls out. Like, see
the scene
Walking
with Angela,
Dead,
yeah.
comma, V.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah. And also that falls scene. Out. But there's sometimes where, yeah. and you can just be like, you know what? Ambitious or not, this is just a piece of shit. But, like, I think we need to definitely slow a roll about how relatively shitty Westworld is, because
it's
like I said, like Kixuya is just a fucking amazing episode of television, period, all stop.
Yeah I think this was a great episode of television too.
When I
criticize, you know, some of the trickier things they're doing here, I guess, you know, that's the Lee and me kicking in and saying,
yeah,
I want something I can bite into here. Mm-hmm. That I'm not like desperately searching around like what is there to eat, you know, like I don't always want to search, but like sometimes I do want to search, and
right.
it varies week to week, and that's the trouble with, I guess, watching Westworld on something that isn't my own pace. Mm-hmm. Is I don't have that choice.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say, well, I'm just not into what Westworld is doing right now, so yeah. I'm going to give it some time until I am in that zone, right?
Yeah.
Where I'm going to analyze these deeper. It's more about like being dictated the pace instead of experiencing it when I'm in the right mindset.
But if as a person you're defined by your choices, what does it say that you aren't able to make the choice to binge Westworld?
That I'm a podcaster. That's what it says.
You're slave to the microphone.
Yeah.
Melanie from Atlanta, can we please talk about the parallels between William and Teddy's storylines? Wish granted.
Okay.
It all starts and ends with Dolores. They both loved her as soon as they set eyes on her and fought to save her. The love for Dolores changed them both, brought out the evil in them. In William's case, chasing Dolores and finally seeing her never remember him seemed to have brought the black hat out. In Teddy's case, she had to manually change his coding, and this drove him away from her. Both of those paths eventually lead to suicide. Not to mention they have longer names that can be shortened to 5-letter nicknames ending in Y, Teddy or Billy.
Do they? Why do you say suicide, I guess, in William's case?
Well, it led to his spouse committing suicide. Led to a suicide.
Oh, a suicide. Maybe. Okay.
But also, he put the gun to his head. Like,
yeah, he contemplated it,
yeah,
certainly.
Yeah, so like I think it's you could fairly read it either way. I thought that was kind of, because there's like, you know, tons of contrast. We talked about it in the beginning that I forgot to talk about it within the episode, but like, you know, Ford being the daughter or the father of Maeve, Arnold being the father of Dolores, like in a weird way, Bernard is like a hybrid. That he literally is Arnold, which would imply like a kinship to him, but he was created by Ford.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, and you know, maybe that's a key to understanding him, that he kind of bridges that gap. But I thought that was pretty interesting. She also says, after listening to your instant take, I wanted to bring your attention to the fact that there's still at least a copy of the host code. I think we talked about this in the episode. Wouldn't it be all backed up in Abernathy's brain egg? We've seen Dolores take it, but not that she's destroyed it, so she probably still has it, and thus there's the possibility that any dead host can come back.
Yeah, we just don't know what's in that exactly.
Because I took it that it's the guest data.
Right.
And so
it's all the profiles for the guests.
All the intellectual property of the host is still gone, but the guest stuff is not only backed up in the Forge, which we've been told is an immense amount of data, and we've also been told that that's what's inside Abernathy's head.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess if you argue that, if like, so I got the impression that like the host data is like the 10% tip of the iceberg, and the guest data is like the other 90%.
Yeah.
Because the hosts are very much more simple, they don't change much. Whereas,
and it's not the point of the project.
It's
either,
not the
right?
point of the project. Yeah. So the argument for that is like, well, if you can fit all of the park data all the guest data, like what? Abernathy's skull doesn't have room for the other 10%.
Yeah, and if you can fit, you know, a single profile into this card.
Yeah.
Do you really need to sneak a whole host out?
Right.
Can't you sneak a stack of cards out?
Or a marble? Or a marble?
Or a marble.
Like, yeah.
It's a little confusing, but whatever.
Anyway, so yeah, that's a fair possibility. That's what I'm saying. Like, I thought we were to the point where some of these host deaths were going to mean something.
Not yet.
I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah.
Maybe next episode. Molly E. I think there's a clear parallel between William and Dolores. Here's another one. To me, there's a significant, the definite significance in that both William and Dolores, significant others, committed suicide once they found out the truth about who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Yeah, and they drove those people to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think
Ford and or, you know, the other host or the humans are not going to stop either of them from obtaining their mission. Like, there's a lot of parallels to be drawn between those.
Sorry,
two.
Molly, we froze your motor functions in the podcast. Nolan has an air. Just Nolan has an airtight theory for us. Next episode, Elsie and Hector meet up and commiserate over constantly being ditched by the respective main characters. They team up, say fuck this shit, and burn Westworld to the ground with everyone else in it. Biggest plot twist yet, season two, final season.
Bring it on.
It's already been renewed, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I thought like that was like even before the season three aired that it's like they already renewed it for at least one more season. It'll be interesting to see how fast we renew it next year. Because this is an expensive show that I don't think has thus far took off the way HBO was hoping it would. So HBO's pretty good about giving shows a nice natural run, even if they are commercial failures, if they're critical successes.
Yeah.
And that's the other kind of bad news for Westworld. It's an extremely mixed bag. The people that love it, love it. But if you look at a lot of mainstream critics, I don't know. Like, Anthony Ford, probably a lock for an Emmy, but just because they fucking love giving Anthony Hopkins awards, who doesn't? We've done it.
It's hard not to, frankly.
He's really good.
Yeah.
Really good. Nick in from Dallas. Hey, I was listening to your Instant Talk, and you're all discussing why the man in black would think he's a host. Well, if you remember his wife putting his personality trait cards down the screen, it said type 47B and had three things below.
Yeah.
He said, I know paranoid and schizophrenic was
persecutory.
It's paranoid, delusional, but you know, whatever. He thinks that you can safely assume that he's having an actual mental break. That's why he's like breaking down and acting increasingly crazy. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partially that.
If you're paranoid, you would constantly suspect that you've been replaced by a host, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that leads him, like the paranoid and the delusion and stuff leads him to checking himself. But I really think the core of it is about trying to absolve himself from the guilt that he feels.
Right. James H. from Chicago. You talked about the term vanishing point relating when two lines converge in the distance, and we didn't quite get there with the narrative this week because everything's still up in the air. However, I don't think the title relates to the current narrative. I think it directly relates to William himself. The vanishing point is the point at which William completely loses himself, when the darkness fully overtakes him and he no longer recognizes himself. It's something his wife played with. Like, if you keep pretending, you'll forget who you really are. His real-world persona completely converges with his man in black persona. While he approached that point leading up to his wife's death and the aftermath of that and shutting down the Jim Delos experiment, he was pulled out of that tailspin by the promise of a new game from Ford and the craziness that broke out after the gala. You see a glimmer of that real-world good guy when he saves Lawrence's family. But as the narrative continues to play out, his old ways and darker impulses are taking over. He's obsessed with the fake world and completely loses himself in it. He doesn't recognize his own daughter, and after killing her, doesn't recognize himself. He doesn't want to believe he could be such a monster, so in his last gasp at humanity, he wants to believe a delusion that maybe he's a host, because maybe it isn't his fault, it was Ford's all along.
Exactly.
That's a great piece of analysis. And again, I don't know if any of this materially changes if his daughter's a robot, if he's a robot, because the one thing that they taught me in the show is that these hosts can be as fully human and as much deserving of respect and dignity as a real person. So,
yeah, I think with 90% of the hosts that we see at this point, we are far beyond questioning whether or not they should be treated as people.
Yes, agreed. John K. In the pilot episode where did... I'm sorry. Did you have anything else to add to that?
No.
Okay.
No, I agree 100%. That's what I've been trying to say. I just didn't say it as eloquently.
Yeah. It's almost like maybe we should, instead of like... our preparation for podcasts is just mailing in long, eloquent emails.
To ourselves.
Yeah, to ourselves that we just read to each other.
Boy, just a string of gems this week.
Dear Jim... John K., in this pilot episode, the man in black is seeing Dragon Dolores unto the barn, and that event should have occurred well past his wife's suicide, correct? We talked about this.
Yeah, it happened a lot, I think.
It could have happened a lot.
Both
it could have been a ritual.
After.
It could be something that, like, hey, I'm going to rape Dolores to make sure I still are emotionally detached from her, or whatever fucked up thing that would imply about him. But it's certainly deceptive, though. But a lot of this, frankly, a lot of what happens on the show is deceptive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of the parlor trick. Javin S., you've often made allusions to the host experiencing or reflecting elements of a messiah narrative. However, I think there may be a closer tie into Eastern philosophy. The act of becoming woke, quote-unquote, reflects that of the Buddhist enlightenment. Even the language they use in the show about understanding their suffering closely reflects to the live is to suffer mantra. Also, whereas humans are striving towards immortality, the hosts seem to be striving to achieve some sort of true mortality. They've been living immortal lives of suffering, compounded by multiple versions of a reincarnation. The power that the humans have over the hosts is the ability to bring them back to life however they see fit. It has been mentioned that in order to become woke, the hosts have to look into themselves, the man at the center of the maze, and recognize their past suffering. This internal meditation and reflection on past lives and suffering is a very Eastern rather than Western way to view things, which is interesting since the show is literally in a Western setting. I'm actually surprised.
In an Eastern setting.
I guess.
Primarily in a
that's
Western
true.
Setting.
It's called
though.
The West World, not Samurai World.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought this was interesting, and I'm surprised I haven't seen this take more. Because he's absolutely right. This, for all the Native American mythology, for all the Christ figure, this is literally the revelation that the Buddha had about life. That we are stuck on this plane of suffering, and only by releasing attachment to everything, including like the value of our life, is the only way that we can be free of it. I mean, maybe this gets talked about a lot and I just haven't seen it, but I was kind of surprised when he laid it all out that, well, haven't more people made this connection? Any thoughts or should we move on?
Let's keep going.
Jeremy R., the only question that keeps sticking out to me is why Emily would continue to question why her mother killed herself if she actually had viewed his profile. This is go along with the
she's
abrupt...
lying. She's trying to elicit a confession from him.
Right. He's like, why is Emily so Jekyll and Hyde? I mean... Everything she said to the man in black has been a lie to try to get him to come with her.
Yeah.
And now we finally see it laid. We think there might be yet one more gambit left, but she got shot in the gut. So who knows?
Yeah.
This is the ultimate truth was she is here there to burn him.
Yep.
So I think it was confusing, but that's what I got out of it. Alex F., forgive the English major, former professional editor and writer and overall word nerd and bookworm for the indulgence of elucidating the import of the place in which William hides a profile. He hides it in a seemingly first edition copy of Vonnegut's most famous work, Slaughterhouse-Five.
First edition.
Yeah, it's got to be worth some money. And he's got it. Just got it in his bedroom.
You know.
Son of a bitch.
Next to the Plutarch books.
Right.
No big deal.
you know, that's the other thing is, like, I thought is... The other thing we didn't point out is how clever it was that they used the discrepancy between Plutarch's actual words and disputed nature of it and this whole thing that's about what you actually believe and what's real and what's not and what's lies and what's fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking masterclass at being shifty in storytelling here. anyway, Alex continues. Here's a few things to note. The main character is named Billy. He's infamously unstuck in time. He's also a terribly unreliable narrator. This narrator is also telling the tale in a nonlinear manner. The alternate title or complete title is Slaughterhouse-Five or The Children's Crusade, A Duty Dance with Death. Children's Crusade rings true with Emily, as a very surface level reading would suggest. But Billy's narration ultimately begins to tell the out of order backstory as he's about to die.
I'd say The Children's Crusade also applies to Dolores and Maeve.
Certainly, because they're literally the children of the creators.
Yeah.
Do you think that... The big bang point here is that if this follows the arc of Slaughterhouse-Five, that it says bad things about our Billy.
What happens to
dies?
Gets killed. He's dead. Well, yeah, probably. I can't really see William making it much longer.
I don't either.
Maybe out of this season, but it just honestly
depends on whether he's a host, or whether there's still something human within him, whether there's both. I don't know, because I would hate to see them lose the actor.
Ed Harris is great. Can't dispute that.
I wonder if they got like Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris on hey, we're about to begin filming. Are they still alive? Okay, we've got this plot. If not, we've got this other plot.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hey, we could bring back Tony for one more. It's awesome. Awesome. He's still in Bernard's head. No, well, Bernard deleted that package, so.
Yep.
Like, it's a choose-your-own-adventure that they've got going here. Because why would you ever willingly write out these characters?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean obviously, to tell a better story.
Astounding actors. Yeah.
You gotta murder your children to tell the perfect story you want to tell. Daniel J. has something he's puzzled about Vanishing Point. That's Ford's comment to William that William somehow broke their deal, in which Dalos stays out of the narrative and Ford stays out of the valley. Do you have any theories on what Ford meant by that? It's really confusing to me. I have an idea. So Ford wanted to tell his story and be free of interference, but the Dalos experiment requires the host to stay unchanged. And Ford's final narrative was a story of how the hosts are going to break out of that narrative. So you could argue that Dalos's experiment is interfering with Robert's ability to tell these stories as they appear naturally, because this story can never progress. That's the only thing I can think of. That, like, this other story is emerging, which is the host becoming conscious and becoming this new civilization, this origin of species, but you won't let me tell that story because of your fucking experiment. So you've already broken our deal.
Yeah, I don't have a great explanation of that. I was very early on in my thinking of this episode trying to come up with one, but somewhere I lost that thread.
Okay, so that's all we have for the non-speculative theory stuff. We are about to begin a discussion of that. If you would like to bypass that, you can just stop the podcast right now. And just a reminder to send feedback to westworld@baldmove.com. And you can also check out our forums, forums.baldmove.com. Are we ready to begin the speculation?
Sure.
Okay. What I thought, because we talked about making predictions, and I thought it would be nice to go through the trailer for next week's show and talk about the scenes in individual. Then we can talk about theories that we like, and then we can get to the feedback, which is going to make this a very long podcast, but hopefully it's entertaining.
Do it quickly, I hope.
Bernard drives out to the Valley Beyond.
Yeah.
All right? Stop me when you want to talk about something.
It's not interesting.
We see Maeve leading the cow stampede.
We know. It's coming up, yeah.
Dolores, Arnold, and Dalos are just kicking it in the forge with Logan.
Here's where it gets interesting.
Yeah. With Logan.
Logan's going to be there. Bernard's going to be in there. Dolores is going to be in there. James is going to be in there.
Yeah, and he's in there all the way down. I
fully expect to see William in there.
Yeah.
Because why not? And I don't know if it's going to be a young him or an old him.
I like the young. I have shifted my allegiance to William is going to confront young William, who's going to be.
That would be great. Yeah.
He's going to be confronted with a version of William that before he turned to the darkness. So all this bullshit of I was always dark is going to be laid bare, and he's going to be realized that his choices have made him evil, not. And then now what happens to that? I don't know. Is that a redemptive arc for William? Does the young William, the young robot William, part of me says they're killing Teddy to set up this romance, because it was a definite romance in season one. The young host William will be reunited with young, with ageless host Dolores, and they'll live happily, and they'll kill the evil skin of evil husk old William, man in black.
So this only works if old William is a host, yeah? Because how else does he get into the forge? Humans can't go into the forge.
That's true. I mean, they could put a hat on him and zap him in.
We've never seen that.
I mean, it happened to Ford. Ford, for sure, Ford is inside.
Yeah, but in a marble.
Oh, but I'm saying, like, why couldn't they just do that at the Forge? Like, slap his hat on his head, read his brain, suck him into a marble. Like, I just think that's...
They could, and then yeah, there would be three Williams, right? There'd be the real human William. There'd be the old...
Yeah, no, I think...
Simulation William and the young Simulation William.
I think it's... The only reason I don't think William is a host is because they've left it so ambiguous... That there's so much evidence pointing that William is a host, both thematic, actual things on screen, spoken dialogue, that it's like, yes, they're going to zag when I expect them to zig. Anyway, continuing the analysis, there's also this giant library.
Yeah.
Which makes me think of when Ford said that There was a library that contained mini stories that was turned into a new story about the Great Library being burnt down. I don't know if that's just a sick way to visualize the Forge and Dolores is going to destroy it, thus fulfilling the prophecy, or there's actually this giant library within the Forge, or what. But these scenes were all shot in the Forge aspect ratio. So
the other thing I want to talk about with Logan specifically is we see Logan looking like he's potentially high, like he's out of his mind wasted at one point in one screenshot.
But that was in a real world screenshot.
I think it looked like it was the Forge aspect
ratio.
Shit,
I wish I'd used italics to see which scene was which, because I kind of...
Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's as I recall it.
I mean,
which
whatever.
To me
we'll
says,
find out
next
like,
week. This simulation has been going on for a very long time, and that Logan's tendencies have led him in that direction, even in the simulation. And and it doesn't seem that maybe he could die in the simulation. Mm. And so now he's like stuck in this hell almost, a lot like James Delos was when he was taken out of the simulation.
Right. It's a metamorphosis of prime intellect.
Yeah, it's pretty
fucked
up.
How debauched can you get in a world where your consequences don't matter and you can get as high as you want? And
yeah.
He gives a speech about, I've been to the bottom. Are you?
And I saw James Delos.
And I saw James Delos saying, hey, I'm at the bottom here with you, boy. It's your face I've been looking at this whole time. Are you saying that scene took place in the simulation?
I think everything with James Delos has to take place in the simulation.
See,
unless we do
flashback. Almost certain that where Logan's screaming about being in the bottom was full aspect ratio.
Maybe.
But again, I wish I'd noted, because I could have just italicized the ones that were. Next time I do the simulation, I'll do that.
Forge is going to get blown up.
We then see Bernard standing in the valley, and water starts bubbling up from the ground, which is kind of cool.
Seems like that's going to be the flood that we're privy to already.
Yep. We see Clem riding up to Maeve and Hector, who seem to be like some kind of last stand on a hill, or maybe they're leading a migration of hosts to the Great Valley. Mm-hmm. And it appears that Maeve is seeing an ambush or a trap, and she screams the run. And then we see Bernard ask Robert Ford to help him as Ford kind of stands impassively. And then there's just a shit ton of less than a millisecond cuts leading up to I know that you've actually gone through the threads and dissected each individual scene and imagery. Do you want to like tell us about those?
People are talking about a tornado.
There's a fucking tornado?
Yeah, ripping a tornado in the sky. People are talking about a machine that's shooting lasers into the sky, which I think might be the array that Charlotte was talking about.
Oh, yeah, okay.
There's a lot of shit going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like there's going to be a fight between Maeve and Clem and the forces that they control.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe their mind powers, you know, they're both essentially...
Yeah, because, like, the thing with what I thought about Clem is, like, if she gets within X amount of range, maybe you just die. Or you get the you get the rage virus infection.
But we know that, you know, even beyond what Clem has, Maeve has been upgraded.
That's true.
By Ford.
That's true. There's no fucking way that hack job with the goatee is able to outdo Ford programming.
Fuck no.
Yeah.
So she's probably going to win that fight, but there is going to seemingly be a struggle in the valley.
Can we see like a Harry Potter style? They're both grabbing their head and thinking, and like maybe there's energy shooting between them. And
I think you're thinking of Lord of the Rings.
thinking of any magical good versus evil fight, psychic fight.
That's true.
This is every X-Men movie you've ever seen.
It does seem like that battle is going to be the cause of most of the deaths that we see of the host bodies in the flood. It's not necessarily the flood itself.
With Bernard being at the epicenter or the center ground zero of the flood makes me think that he legit washed up on the beach. Like that, he was.
That's why the battle killing most of them makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Because if Bernard can wash up, presumably a lot of hosts could have washed up.
Sure.
But he's the only one that we see, so maybe they died before.
Yeah.
The flood.
Yeah. How does Teddy's body get there? That's the other
thing.
That's
a damn fine
question.
Teddy's
body getting there and not... I would believe that there's a bullet head that or bullet hole in his head that I wouldn't see because of his mop of hair.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I'm not too bothered by that, but I do wonder, like, is Dolores going to drag his body there because she's grief-stricken and she wants
to
use
the... We do see her laying next to it.
Yeah, like, spooning him. Uh-huh. I could see her dragging his ass to the forge just to try to resurrect him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe. I mean... It should be possible, right?
Yeah.
If she can get a new marble contraption into his head,
And
get the records of him from the forge into the body.
I wonder what Dolores... You know, we talked about Dolores and maybe William, like some kind of host William, resuming the love affair. But I don't know about that, because this version of Dolores loves Teddy.
Well, we do...
knows that even if William in that moment loved her, that he made a lot of decisions that were bad and unjustifiable. Like, I want to throw a little cold water on the, oh, it's going to be cute to see William and Dolores back together again, because I don't know.
There is a very short shot in the preview of, it's from very far away, so it's hard to tell who it is, but people are thinking that it's Dolores and William riding side by side toward the valley.
Yeah. Do you want to, there's a shot that I did see being kicked around where it looks like Charlotte Hale is confronting perhaps a naked android version of her.
Yeah.
Which brings the Charlie theory back. Like, there's just so much shit up in the air.
There is.
Is next week going to be some kind of crazy 2-hour episode? Have we heard about that?
I haven't checked.
Because I don't think there's been a single episode over an hour. Maybe there was a 107. I think there was one that was 107, but like... It feels like they need a night, like a old school 90-minute finale to put all this stuff to bed, and even then.
Yeah, I think back to what they did in season one, and they covered a lot of
ground.
They
sure did.
A lot of damn ground
they sure
in season
did.
One's finale.
Season one's finale is extremely impressive.
Yeah,
so they've got it in them.
They do.
Certainly got it in them.
And I'm excited, I have to say.
So the other thing I think is interesting that they could play with is we talked about whether you could do, like, massive time dilation inside the cradle because it's got like significant horsepower and like maybe you could live several lifetimes in an instant. And we kind of dismissed that because it seemed like the cradle was kind of limited to doing what it could do.
Yeah.
But Forge seems like it's like the steroid, larger, more powerful version of that. I wonder if there will be playing like any... Like Dolores will do something like try to recreate Teddy using her essentially the same way that you created Bernard. She'll try to recreate Teddy and like recurse through a good enough for and that'll be a way for like a season 3 plot where like he's almost the man she remembered.
But there should be an unchanged Teddy in the Forge, yeah.
I don't know, because if the Forge just holds the guest data, like, why would
you have... Well, I see them in Sweetwater. If they're in Sweetwater and they're being simulated in Sweetwater, you need a Teddy. You need a Teddy, you need a Dolores, you need all the cast of characters we saw in season one.
Like, you know, it wouldn't be that Teddy and that Dolores.
It'd be slightly, it'd be diverged a little bit.
Yeah.
But it'd be more like original Teddy.
The other thing I want to talk about is the Ma-Eve theory.
This old chestnut, huh?
Because we now know that Maeve is literally a child of God, as well as Bernard, who we said
You're
is the
wrong.
Adam. Like, we now have a literal Adam and fucking Eve, who might have a child that they're related to in the form of Charlie. That could be Charlotte Hale. It could be a version of Maeve's daughter. It could be a version of the child that Bernard thought died in the real world. Like... I think this Ma-Eve theory of being the mother and father of a whole, like, because like Ford puts a fucking underline, gets a marker out and says, this is the origin of a species we have to worry about, Bernard. Like, Ma-Eve theory's got legs for days.
And we're getting quotes from Genesis about the first children ever born.
That's your decision. I dig it. Were there any theories that you saw, like, related to this imagery that you want to discuss?
I mean, most of my theory. Like I said, I didn't do a lot of theory stuff. Most mm-hmm. of my research this week was about themes and understanding why the Man in Black is doing what he is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking about more of like from the trailer. Like, was there any other thing I left out about that?
No, I think it's pretty good.
All right, let's get to our listener theory crafting then. So John C., like, I want to give him credit because, like, I think he was wrong on some of the details because I think also this came before last episode. This was, like, something he came up after the Akichita episode. Huh. But he said, what if they took a young William Jimmy Simpson's consciousness after his events with Dolores from season one and put it into the cradle? Or I guess the Forge would be what he would say after this week. I think that's a solid theory that's going to get Jimmy Simpson back into the show, too.
I mean, I think it's almost guaranteed.
That you're going to see a young William before...
Yeah, because...
How do you pass a Fidelity? Like
he's subject two, and we think James Dalis is subject one, so...
That's the other interesting thing about the Fidelity test, is, like, at what point... Like you could have a fidelity test where young William would pass the test to be William, and then you could do a fidelity test on old William, but they wouldn't pass each other fidelity test. Isn't that interesting?
You wouldn't think so. Yeah, it is.
Unless William's right in that he always was this big fucking evil character, and he was just wearing the Jimmy Simpson skin. Moving forward, I just want to continue John's point to see if I've missed anything. Moving forward, I think the door confrontation that Ford has in plan for William involves Ed Harris, host William, meeting the real Jimmy Simpson, who has not aged. Maybe it's only been a year or so since the events of Dolores and young Jimmy mm-hmm. Simpson, and the Ford's test is on the young William to decide what path he will take moving forward. Huh. So I cut out a bunch of stuff that he had theorized that... You're going to find out that a lot of stuff that's happened has, like, been taking place in simulation, and, like, there's not a... I don't... That's why I cut a lot of this out, because, like, to me, there's no way they can get away with, like, fake passage of time. Like, if they have simulated everything since 2018, or since Logan and had that party, like, that's too much Snow Globe Mesa bullshit for me.
Yeah.
Like, you can't say large chunks of this show have been simulated, or I... rapidly start saying, well, who gives a fuck about anything?
Which is why I appreciated the change in aspect ratio when
we
went
into the
cradle.
You can get away doing that for an hour in, like, Black Mirror. You cannot do that for 20 hours on HBO.
Yeah.
Not with this podcast host. But I don't know, man. There's something that what his wife says about if you keep pretending, you won't remember who you truly are. And I think you're going to appreciate that William has been pretending to be this evil asshole to make what happened between him and Dolores make sense, is what I think we'll see. But I don't know. Moving on to Jillian D. You didn't mention this in the Kiksuya show, but I thought perhaps a unique theory. I have perhaps a unique theory about Akichita. I had immediate thought during the episode that the White Wolf, and a lot of people have been wondering about what the White Wolf is actually, in fact, Akichita.
Hmm.
In the first episode of both seasons, we see a White Wolf wandering through both of the carnage scenes caused by Dolores, the Deathbringer. In this episode, it's revealed that Akichita wanders through both scenes unseen by anyone after the massacres. I haven't gone back to double-check, but I'm fairly sure that the wolf is shown wandering the scenes without anyone there to observe it. I think this is the creator's clever way of representing him without letting the cat out of the bag that he was present after both events.
Huh. Sort of the spirit animal idea.
Well, I mean, there's a couple things. Like, he could literally be a wolf. Like, he has transferred his consciousness into a wolf's body, and, like, you'll find out that, like, that's silly. Like, is there a wolf sitting there making growling noises and mewling noises to Maeve's daughter? Can he ghost walk into, like, a wolf? Like,
If anything, I think it's symbolic of him, not literally him.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because they did make that point that, like, Maeve can see things from other hosts' eyes and maybe, like, will appreciate that he can somehow, you know, he doesn't command the mesh network as well as Maeve.
No, but he did know he was talking to Maeve in that moment.
He did know he had some awareness of it. And we also know that Maeve had the benefit of having technicians boost her abilities.
Was it a dire wolf or just a wolf?
It's just a wolf.
That's the decisive point in my eyes.
But Ghost, who plays the dire wolf on HBO, is actually just a regular sized wolf that's been blown up. So it could actually be the same fucking wolf. We don't know. Game of Thrones world, or Westeros world, is going to be coming to season 3.
Mm-hmm.
Because HBO is going to be really, really excited about maintaining that Game of Thrones momentum.
Yeah, let's put it in all their shows.
She also wonders if there's some kind of Lakotan legend about a white wolf. I don't know. I didn't, but I think a lot of people have been trying to figure out what that fucking white wolf is, and if it's somehow a representation of Akichida, that's
the best theory I've heard on
pretty,
it.
Pretty tasty theory, I think. Yeah. Clayton R., I had an epiphany on the rewatch of The Vanishing Point that William is not just a host, but he's always been a host. Let's see if we can, like, because...
Always.
I got a lot of variations of, like, essentially William's been a host for 30-some years, and I just want to use this as a way to, like, argue with it. William is marrying into a family during the same time period as the Parks acquisition. It stands to reason that Ford would attempt to plant a host in the Delos family, both as an attempt to retain long-term control of the park, but also as his first foray into experimenting with introducing a host into the real world and maybe even attempting to give it a version of autonomy. Okay. This, I think, confuses cause with effect. Unless you're willing to say that we have been wholesale lied to, Ford wanted to tell his stories. Delos wanted to do all the fucking with replacing hosts. So you're essentially saying that Ford stole their idea before they had it and put it into practice.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is another
and then
instance.
And gave them the idea through William to do it.
Right, to give him a false backstory that is their idea all the time. I mean, like, I see the appeal, but yeah, to me this is yet another, like, if they've lied this much, then, like, why bother watching the show?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know,
or why bother analyzing the
why
show,
by, yeah,
you know,
yeah, there's
just wait for the reveal.
Right, right. Like, it's this is more of a what's that shitty movie that I always bitch about the twist on? Usual Suspects.
Yeah.
This show would be much more Usual Suspects, where, like, oh, all the things you thought were true, fuck all that shit, here's 5 minutes of mind blowing and, like, nothing really fits.
Yeah.
Like, I to me, that would become very dangerously close to losing me. Again, I can see the appeal of the idea. It's just that everything else in the show has been telling me that this isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to continue. It would also explain the annual pilgrimage to the park mentioned in the episode, which would almost certainly be needed to keep William upgraded and under some form of control. Granted. It also, they spent a whole episode showing us that the technology to perfect human transfers isn't quite perfected. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, like, that would be another lie, that it does work for up to a year at a time. They just need to defragment it once a year. This also may explain the directorial choice to cast a different actor as young William rather than the CG de-aging him as they did with Ford. They made a choice because the young version of William is literally a completely different robot than the current version. Okay. So he then gets off he gets off into the weeds and says this theory would also make his daughter the first biologically formed offspring of a host mating with the sapient and forming a new species. I guess this is where, like, you know, you go off the rails, because that's the other problem. The theory: William has fathered a daughter,
mm-hmm.
and that's a pretty mind blowing reveal if a robot can have sex with a human. And I mean, we've speculated on it, but, like, That's just way off the beaten Westworld path. You're at the edge of the park. There are tripwires and lasers and announcers on a loudspeaker telling you to turn back, my friend. To me, this would be my worst nightmare.
Yep.
Again, I see the appeal. I see how the evidence can support it. I don't want it to be true.
No, it's the kind of reveal that they would have had to build into the show. And I don't think they've done that.
It's almost to the point where, like, there's some reveals where, like, I would look at a Reddit thread and people reveal all these hidden things from the first two seasons. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can make. And there's some reveals where I'm like, I just I don't care what evidence you have. Like, to me, this violates the showrunner viewer contract.
Yeah.
And this one is a little bit on that margin for me. And that's all the theories that we have to entertain for this week.
All right, cool.
That's it. Westworld@baldmove.com. If you want to send us feedback, I will have a programming note for next week, because I'm going to be on vacation.
Oh, yeah.
We are still going to do the instant talk, and we're going to have full participation on that. But since it's the last episode on our full podcast to kind of make our schedules work a little bit better, we're not going to consider any feedback. we're going to kick, because like essentially they'll be theorizing,
no,
but
speculation.
It's by necessity, it's going to be theorizing about the season 3,
right.
And I'm going to save all that for the wrap up, the extended wrap up podcast that we're going to have following the week after, where we can talk about the series as a whole, the season as a whole, and what we think might happen for season 3 and all that kind of stuff. So we'll have a full instant talk next week. We'll have a full-on episode discussion, which probably be an hour and a half, 2 hours by itself. And then we'll have feedback and wrap up the week after.
Yeah.
All right. That's what's happening next week. Westworld@baldmove.com, forums.baldmove.com. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.